Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
They don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to talk with Lee Fong from the Center for American Progress about all the craziness that's going around. Really, since the last election cycle, a little bit before, this heated rhetoric, what I'm saying is culminated in and some heated things, some unusual events, some threats, some problems. So we'll talk to him. Todd Spencer from the Owner Operators Independent Drivers Association going to be here talking about opening up the Mexican border. If you want to hear the rhetoric get ratcheted up, you want to see some craziness going on, I think opening up the Mexican border to Mexican truck drivers would be a colossal mistake. But we'll find out what their thoughts at the Owner Operator Independent Drivers Association is. Also, Erwin Aronson, our good friend, going to talk about some of the things we're going to see coming up in the state of Pennsylvania. Will the Corbett administration pursue right to work laws? And what is it? You talk to people, we should all have the right to work. And I agree, we should all have the right to work. Under what conditions? And what exactly does that nice flowery language mean if Pennsylvania becomes the first northeastern state to become a right to work for less state? So that ought to be interesting as well. I'm wondering how John Boehner's cocktail party went for his 168 fat cats at the Republican National Committee. The schmoozing started about 7 p.m. tonight. And I'm told that they had planned. I don't know that they did it. I'm not sure. We haven't gotten early reports that they watched the president's speech from Arizona. But they said they were going to. They said they were going to take time from their fundraising and drinking and carousing and deal-making to watch it on TV. And, the thought keeps popping into my head that Republicans seem to spend a lot of time in front of the TV. First, it's Pete Sessions and Mike Fitzpatrick taking the oath of office via the television monitor, and now this. The big cocktail party was being held at the very swanky National Harbor Resort in Maryland. So, hey, they need the money, especially after Michael Steele, the Blinginator, who has spent them into the hole. And I love this whole debate that's going on over there. Somehow he was this complete incompetent, and some of the whispering, the under the dog whistle politic is, he's just like that black guy in the White House. When the reality of the RNC's trouble is that the really wealthy donors gave their money to the Karl Roves of the world, the other euphemistically named front groups, because they didn't need to go through the RNC. They were able to take their hate message right to the public. But it makes a good story. It makes a good story for them to say that Steele stuck it to them. So that's interesting stuff. But I'm looking at this tragedy that happened on Saturday, and, man, it is just being spun by the masters of manipulation, history being revised to fit the new message of today. I mean, Sarah Palin just what can you say? Personally, I think she's political toast. You know, the claims that the crosshairs were, they were something else. The reality is they could be little angels from heaven for all I care. We all know what they were, and we all know what they were for. It's this dog whistle politic. We have certain buzzwords that grab the evangelicals. We have certain, you know, phrases that grab the militia types. The financiers, they have their little code words. The privateers, they've got their code words. Back in his Mormon speak, they've got their little language going on as well. And, you know, I gotta be honest, I listened to Sarah Palin's big speech, that took her, you know, what is today? Wednesday? So Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, finally on the fourth day she spoke. A whole bunch of jumbled, not much there. A lot of platitude, a lot of pandering, not much substance, but one thing that did grab me by the throat was this.
In the hour when our values are challenged, that we must remain resolved to protect those values.
It is in our challenging hour that we must protect our values, she says. And again, going back and maybe doing a little revision.
Recall the events of 9/11 challenged our values, and we had to fight the tendency to trade our freedoms for perceived security.
Yeah. So, you know, we had to fight back. Every time I go through the airport, I have to take my shoes off. I've got to go through the naked scanners. I've got to be groped. And to be honest, you know, if it were nice-looking women, I wouldn't mind being groped. But the sad reality is it's not. And you look at this stuff, this heated rhetoric, this... And then turning your back and saying, well, we didn't do it, is ridiculous. We now see an arrest in California. A guy named Charles Turner. Charles Turner Haberman, his name is, of Palm Springs, California. He was charged with threatening a federal official. He threatened Jim McDermott, Democrat from Washington. And why? Why did he choose to? And this is what gets me. Why did he choose? Well, evidently, Representative McDermott opposed extending the Bush tax cuts for the very wealthy here in the country. And evidently, this guy was pretty upset about it. So he left some pretty interesting messages on the congressman's voicemail, which, you know, he can't be too smart. You never leave anything. You never write anything down. You never leave anything recorded. Anyway, the first call, Haberman said that he had seen McDermott on television, was enraged by his comments opposing the tax cuts for the rich. And this is, you know, I gotta bleep some of this because, you know, it is what it is. He's a piece of human filth. He's a liar. He's a communist. He's a piece of garbage. According to Haberman's message, this in the criminal complaint, Haberman said that George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and other U.S. founding fathers would blow his brains out. Haberman then threatened to kill McDermott as well as his friends and family, according to the complaint. As if that wasn't enough, our phone friend decided, ding, round two. So he picks up the phone again, and in a second call said he had a lot of money and a lot of friends who have money, and that McDermott was going down. Now, you know, I kind of understand, you know, a little venting. I kind of understand a little frustration. I got to be honest, I was angry that it passed. And I think most working class people who are struggling to make ends meet were angry when it passed. I know very few of us who picked up the phone and said, gee, I'm coming after you for doing that. It's the few, the insane. But it's the people that get the dog whistle. It's the people who hear those coded messages. You know, like we talked with Phil Hare last night. You know, when they say we're going to kill the bill. We're going to destroy them. That's part of the messaging. And you look yesterday in Colorado, a guy was arrested for threatening to shoot the aides of Senator Michael Bennett. Why? He was upset about his Social Security benefits. And he told one of the staffers that he was going to come down and shoot y'all. That's what the police said. He was going to set the building on fire. And he may go to terrorism. And the sad thing is Politico is reporting that the threats against members of Congress have increased 300% in the first few months of 2010 and 400% against the White House since 2009. U.S. Marshals Service reports that inappropriate communications directed at the judiciary, U.S. attorneys and other court officials have risen from 1,100 to almost 1,400. So we're seeing this kind of this heated rhetoric. And what it is well, you have the right to call them and scream at them. You can give them a piece of your mind and don't go lightly. Give it to them both barrels. Get out there and shoot your mouth off. But it's the kind of stuff that is a great concern. Because for the most part, these are just angry people who may never act on what they're saying. In fact, they're just venting. They're angry. They're frustrated. They need somewhere to go. But the reality is we live in dangerous times. And I look at the Palmetto State Armory, who has just released a commemorative, limited edition, You Lie assault weapon so that you can commemorate the You Lie statement by Joe Wilson.
You lie! You hate America!
Yeah! See, it's that kind of heated rhetoric. Yeah, you hate America. I mean, isn't it just plain insane, Jake?
Connect that with an assault weapon?
I mean, come on.
Haven't we learned anything? You know, really, the last 2 days, a commentator said something tonight, and I said, yeah, he's exactly right. He said, you would think after something like this would happen, you know, the whole political establishment would kind of tone down the rhetoric. It's actually been incendiary. It's on both sides, it's like, woof, you know, you put a flame on it, and it's just like making a barbecue, you know.
Especially at my house.
That first match, it goes woof. Well, that's exactly what's happened. I mean, it's pointing out exactly what is wrong, at a heightened pace. What happened out here in Arizona, and maybe later on in the program we can talk about, but there's, in my mind, there's a couple issues that we as a nation, we have to come to grips with.
Yeah, like we talked with Phil Hare last night about, you know, he was telling stories of himself being accosted, some of the things that have happened to friends of his, the sheer terror. And I gotta wonder, who in their right mind would want to do that job? Given that kind of heated rhetoric. And I wonder, the people who were swept in on this, how are they going to react? The people who this heated rhetoric, who this anger put into power, how are they going to fare? Because I'm really kind of interested to see this. Because the people who supported them, the people who really pushed them in, they're going to be demanding. And they're going to want something. And if these folks don't deliver, what does it mean for them? I mean, this is going to be an interesting couple of months. Because I think the hot spots are going to be the next 6 months. Because the real hot stuff is going to come out in the next 6 months. Because they're going to start running for re-election, you know, in the fall, of course. But it will definitely be interesting. Most certainly. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Lee Fong from the Center for American Progress about just this and some of the things that have been going on, some of the work that they're doing there. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Thought-provoking, opinionated. Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. 17,000 nurses have a new tentative labor contract agreement with Kaiser Permanente in California. The California Nurses Association, National Nurses United, says the tentative agreement covers 21 hospitals and 40 medical offices across Northern and Central California. The union says more than 20 important professional and economic enhancements were achieved, but further details aren't being released until the nurses have a chance to vote on approval of that contract. The California Nurses Association says the achievements were possible in a state with a minimum nurse-to-patient ratio law. CNA-NNU says it's very pleased to recommend that its members approve this contract because it protects patients and defends hard-fought economic and practice standards. The San Francisco Labor Council is supporting WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, and Bradley Manning. In a resolution passed by the Labor Council, it opposed efforts by the U.S. and other governments to criminalize, financially destroy, and shut down WikiLeaks. The San Francisco Labor Council says documents exposed by WikiLeaks have exposed the criminal record of the U.S. government in violating international agreements and committing war crimes against people throughout the world. In its resolution, the Labor Council urged other unions to publicly affirm and defend freedom of the press and the ability to expose and criticize government wrongdoing. For the first time since reality television became regular content, a union has won the right to organize writers and producers. Jesse Russell reports.
Being non-union is no longer a fantasy for 100 writers and producers of reality television shows from Atlas Media and ITV Studios. The Writers Guild of America East has been in a long ongoing battle to win the right to represent reality television show writers. Reality television is still a new industry, and show production companies have been hesitant to label the writers the same way they would label writers for fiction shows. Unions seeking to organize such workers have argued that the producers and writers of these shows essentially create a narrative out of the sometimes thousands of hours of footage. The Guild will now enter negotiations with Atlas. ITV is appealing their election results. The next top for the Guild is Lion TV, which has 85 writers. Lion TV produces the mid-afternoon hit show, Cash Cab.
Job discrimination claims are substantially up, according to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. The EEOC said last year saw the most complaints in the organization's 45 years. The commission saw 100,000 new complaints and resolved a record 104,999 private sector claims. As a result of the claims, employers paid out $404 million to workers who alleged they were discriminated against at the workplace. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit Labor Radio.
Where common sense, reason, and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you want to watch what's going on here in the studio, therickSmithShow.com is the place to do it. Live video streaming from there. What are you thinking about this? What does all this mean? Yesterday we heard some guy saying the shooting happened because, well, the shooter didn't have enough God in his life. There wasn't enough Jesus in his life. So he was whole. He was not whole. He was void of any goodness. Really? And now today, you've got the idea as somebody is spinning, he did it because he had too much pot in his life. So from one extreme, that not enough God, too much pot. Yeah, that's right. Former Bush speechwriter David Frum, he writes, quote, after horrific shootings, we hear calls for stricter gun laws. The Tucson shooting reminds us why we regulate marijuana. The man held as the Tucson shooter has been described by those who know him as a pot-smoking loner. He had two encounters with the law, one for possession of drug paraphernalia, which he spelled improperly. We are also learning that Lautner exhibited signs of severe mental illness, likely schizophrenia. The connection between marijuana and schizophrenia is both controversial and complicated. The raw, strong association is strong, though. Schizophrenics are twice as likely to smoke marijuana as non-schizophrenics, and people who smoke marijuana are twice as likely to develop schizophrenia as those who don't. But is this correlation causation? Increasingly, experts say yes. So I'm looking at this and I'm going, wow. And, you know, maybe some of my pot friends will have the other view of this. Most people, and I've never smoked pot, not because I'm a goody two-shoes, but because, you know, I, I would probably be the best pot smoker on the planet by now. I guess I watched the movie Reefer Madness, and maybe I took to heart. But you know, here's the thing: most of my pot smoking friends, they really don't have the get up and go. They really don't have the will most of the time. That since I, you know, these are just people that I know. I'm sure there are some pot smokers out there who do marathons and all that stuff. I just haven't met them. But to say that, you know, the reason this guy did it is because he smoked pot. Kind of dumb. But you know, I guess you got to find any excuse. You got to pull any excuse out of the sphincter hole to make your point, I guess, huh?
As this goes on and more days transpire from the day of the massacre, you find more and more information. For instance, when he was kicked out of college, you know, the security people went to his house, talked to his parents, and said, look, your son really needs help. I mean, it got to the point where they threw him out of the college because they were afraid for the safety of the other students. And apparently his parents didn't get him help. I mean, that encompasses the whole issue of mental illness in this country.
Well, but here's the thing. I don't heap it on the parents, because the kid was an adult. The parents could do nothing. They could forcibly do nothing. He was above the age of 18. I can't do anything about you. So the parents couldn't do anything either. Now the kid may have had some problems, but I don't want to blame the parents, because you know, the kid's an adult.
Well, the point is that the college didn't have any leverage at that point to say, look, you have to have help. This wasn't the first time. I mean, he has years and years of experiences where he exhibited, characteristics that, quite frankly, point to the fact that he's mentally unbalanced. And we have a real crisis in this country, and that's another issue. Again, it comes down to money. Where do you find most people that are insane, quite frankly, have mental problems? You find them either homeless, which we've exhibited. We found some people like that. Either homeless or in prisons, and we warehouse them, unfortunately. And there's a correlation between homelessness and those who are in prison. And mental problems, if you're homeless, many times just to survive, oftentimes you do things that violate the law. So we got a real problem in this country when it comes to mental illness. We haven't adequately addressed it. And then you get into the issue of how did this man, who was clearly insane,
see, I disagree. I'm not going with the clearly insane defense. Look, there are people who aren't wrapped too tight, who do all kinds of things. They rarely stalk out a congresswoman and shoot her in the head. To me, there's got to be more to this than just, you know, some of the stuff that I've been reading. Here's a kid who couldn't find a job. He had no direction in life. Look, you know, we have a media culture that glorifies this kind of stuff. You know, you look at the picture of him, he knew exactly what he did. He was happy as can be that he was getting the attention. Is that mental illness? Maybe a little bit, but at the end of the day,
what you're saying is there were societal pressures, and that's probably true too, but I mean, it's clear that the kid mentally had some real severe problems, Rick.
I know a lot of people who have some severe problems, Jake. I look at the cross of the table at you. I don't think you're going to go out because Bill Schuster or Todd Platts or even Tim Holden, who you were very angry at over the healthcare bill, I don't think you're going to go out and do anything dumb like this. Granted, you know, I do agree that there were some mental problems there, but I'm not going to chalk this up to, well, he's just completely insane, and let's put him into a hospital and let him out in a couple of
weeks. Well, let's put it this way. I think this is a fair statement. He fell through the cracks. Somewhere along the line, he should have gotten some help. And I disagree with the parents. He was living at home. The parents could have applied some pressure. And I do believe there are some situations where you can actually have people committed or at least force them.
If they're a danger to themselves. Right. And how are you going to prove that?
Well, you go to court and you try to prove it.
That happens, yeah.
And supposedly, this I didn't know either, this came out in some news reports that the day of the shooting.
He got stopped.
No, his father.
Yeah, chased him down the street.
His father saw him get this duffel bag out of his car, right. And he chased him. He chased him reportedly, I guess, in the cornfield or whatever. And he disappeared, and the rest is history. And with the weak gun laws, I thought about whether I should mention that because of my buddy, you know, our buddy Mike, And those who are strong advocates of the Second Amendment are going to say, well, why did you bring that up? Well, the truth is that Arizona has very weak gun laws. Very weak gun laws.
Yep.
And plus, I understand they're also way behind. They haven't invested in technology, Rick, where the information that these, you know, prospective gun buyers, the information as to whether they have they're convicted felons or whether they have a history of mental illness, because of the lack of investment in updated technology, Arizona does not always get that information into the national bank that they need to, information bank. And that's a problem, too.
But according to a spokesman, John Boehner is saying that they're going to be rejecting Peter King's gun control bill, which they claim would have prohibited people from carrying guns within 1,000 feet of members of Congress. Eric Cantor, the majority leader, is reserving his judgment. Boehner's rejection, quote, illustrates the difficulty gun control advocates will face in moving forward with any legislation. And at the end of it, as you've said, you know, had they had just very minimal laws, with his background, especially being denied the ability to go to the military, he would have been denied here in this state, from what I've been told. So just a very simple law they don't have.
Well, and then
I got to be honest, though, what surprised me, and I said this last night, what really surprised me in a state where everybody carries guns, that it didn't turn into the shootout at the OK Corral. Because a couple of the people who were interviewed, you know, who were, you know, getting their couple of minutes of fame, hey, I came around the corner, I had my gun in my hand, and, you know, I'm surprised someone didn't see someone else and end up having a volley back and forth. That's surprising to me.
Two points, Rick. The NRA has always said, well, you don't take guns away from citizens that obey the law. And I've heard spokesmen say, yes, if they have a criminal record and if they have a history of mental illness, they shouldn't get it. Well, this is exactly what we have here. We had a man who probably shouldn't have got it. And here's another issue. You know, and I know that 30 bullet clip would have been illegal. Under the, what was it, automatic
under
weapons?
Under the Clinton ban. Bill. Under the Brady bill.
The Brady bill. And that was, I believe, let go. It was let go to expire and it was never renewed.
Thanks to Shrub.
Yep. Here's the thing. I don't have a problem, and I know you don't, although some people might accuse it. I don't have a problem with anybody carrying a gun for self-protection. Why do you need a 30-round clip? That is denied. Oh, come on, close. Come on, cut me a break here. That is designed to kill as many people in a shorter period of time. That's what it's designed for.
Or you're just a really bad shot.
Well, I mean, you know, if somebody's trying to kill you, you're probably, you know.
You know, most people are not.
Within easy reach.
Most people are not TV shooting the gun that never runs out of bullets. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, Lee Fong will be on the line from the Center for American Progress. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I'll never bend. I'm with you now.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
In response to Tea Party agitation, the new Republican leaders in the House have been strutting around as reformers, coming across as suit-and-tie versions of that guy on the TV show, Dirty Jobs. We're going to clean up the place, they exclaim, starting with that big legislative stain called earmarks. No more secret diversions of taxpayers' money into lawmakers' pet pork barrel projects, decreed the new House Speaker, John Boehner. Posing as a reborn Mr. Clean, Boehner fairly sparkled at a press conference to announce that he was banning earmarks. So that's that. Mission accomplished, right? No. What the GOP has done is simply sweep earmarks under the rug. Take Senator Mark Stephen Kirk, for example. The Illinois Republican was a scathing critic of earmarks last year, even as he used his position on the Appropriations Committee to force the Education Department to funnel more than $1 million of stimulus money into an Illinois school district. Sounds like an earmark, doesn't it? But technically it wasn't. Rather than directing the money to Illinois by way of the Appropriations Bill, he did it by way of a letter to the department. This is known to insiders like Kirk as letter marking. There's also phone marking, where the dirty deed is done by a phone call from a legislator to an agency head. Another slick move called account marking happens when a member pads the budget of a particular agency, then demands that the extra funds be spent on the member's special project. All of these slick tricks add up to billions of tax dollars every year. This is Jim Hightower saying, Mr. Clean wants our applause for a change that is nothing but a deceit. In an act of raw hypocrisy, Boehner has changed the name of the earmark game, but the scam remains the same. Now, think about it. That really is a dirty job, isn't it? To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. You rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make history happen!
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Let's have a tea party.
Back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. You know, one of my favorite statements, I think, on this, one of the most disgusting statements, really, Tea Partier out in Arizona said, you know, well, you know, she should have had protection. She knew this was a political ploy. Kind of along the, she was asking for it. At least that's the way I took it. I've got Lee Fong on the phone from the Center for American Progress. Lee, welcome to the program.
Rick, thank you so much for having me on.
You know, I'm looking at this tragedy and the way it's being spun on all sides of the equation. I mean, you could look at a guy who was just nuts, but the rhetoric had to play in this, in my opinion.
Well, you know, just to back up for a moment, there are a lot of things at play, and we don't know the exact motives or intentions of the shooter, Jared Loughner. But, you know, this attack, this shooting, comes after a series, a pattern of right-wing violence that has been happening almost every other month for the past 2 years. The only reason this is receiving so much attention is because it was successfully carried out, and the target was a member of Congress rather than a Pittsburgh police officer or someone else of a smaller media stature. And, you know, looking at just the climate of hate right now, you know, it's normal for a right-wing media person or a right-wing politician to dehumanize the other side, to say that they're evil, that they're like Hitler, or they're like Mao, or they're like Stalin, and they're going to destroy the country. So, it shouldn't come to any surprise that people are reacting in a violent way.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you bring that up because a video popped into my head with you in it, actually, where you're talking to one of the Koch brothers and his handler. And you know, Brett, my chief engineer over here, and I marveled at the fact that the guy goes, yeah, he's Lee Fong. He lives in blah, 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 and kind of letting you know that they know where you live.
Yeah, it's a little bit strange. You know, I've registered for Republican events. This one incident happened in Pittsburgh, and it was a Koch-funded event, and I registered to go attend. And on my way there, I stopped at a hot dog stand in Pittsburgh, and I noticed that on a right-wing blog, they had seen that I had registered, and they put my name up there and what year I was born and information about me and said, you know, Lee's coming. We know this progressive blogger's coming. We're ready for him. and put my information on the web. So, I mean, you know, I get it. We come from different ideological sides, but the type of confrontation that they're kind of approaching some of these political matters in a way, they're doing it in a way that they're targeting the other side and making us enemies. And I think that's different because we're not talking about policy when we're using that kind of tone.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. We, you know, we talked to Congressman Phil Hare last night, and he was telling us some of the things that, you know, some of the threats that he's received and how evidently this isn't, you know, for most people, they're just now hearing that, you know what, Congress people get death threats on a fairly regular basis. They get accosted while going to movie theaters on a fairly regular basis. Do you think this is going to do anything to change the rhetoric, or is this just another bump in the road, towards, you know, more and more of the same?
You know, initially I thought this was a game changer, that leaders on the right would tone things down and the media would fairly scrutinize what's going on in this country and people would realize the real danger that some of these members of Congress and people like even George Soros and other folks on the left who are demonized on a daily basis face, because they get death threats all the time as well. But, you know, watching the right's reaction in the past 48 hours, I don't think many things are going to change. The media... The radio show hosts like Glenn Beck and Limbaugh are just as vitriolic. The front groups that have organized a lot of this hate they aren't changing. They're again sending out emails trying to fundraise off this tragedy and still using that same vitriolic hate rhetoric. So I don't see things changing. I see people actually just buying more weapons.
Yeah, and you know, like the one in South Carolina, you know, the You Lie assault weapon.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a structural reason for this. You know, we can talk about the hate radio personalities like Mark Levin, or we could talk about Fox News, but there's an actual structural reason that a lot of this intimidation goes on. And just to go back to that Koch point, I did a story in 2009 during the healthcare town hall protest. Americans for Prosperity, this Koch-funded group, they basically went to town halls hosted by Tom Perriello, the congressman from Virginia, or former congressman now, and they were literally bringing these crazy birthers to the town hall and giving them and goading them on to go to the microphone and yell in Tom Perriello's face. I saw them doing it, and I interviewed them afterwards. I even talked to the birther, and I asked, you know, who brought you here? What brought you to this event? He told me Ben Marchi brought him. He's like a Koch-funded operative. He used to be a Tom DeLay staffer who runs Americans for Prosperity, Virginia. And, you know, Tom Perriello has received death threat after death threat after death threat. You know, a Tea Party leader in near Charlottesville, Virginia, posted what he thought was the home address of Tom Perriello and told Tea Party people to go protest him at his family's home. And he didn't know that was actually Tom Perriello's brother's address. And lo and behold, I think the next week, someone in the middle of the night went over and cut the gas line to that house. So, I mean, these threats are really real. They're not to be laughed at all.
Yeah, and you know, as I said last night on the program, I've been angry with some of my representative votes. I've been angry with, you know, some of the things that they've done. Never once have I thought of going to their home or accosting them in any way. It's part of our democracy. It's part of our you know, the way we do business here. We vote them out. We don't shoot them.
That's... Sure, and you know, there's. I mean, I was very active in the anti-war movement in college, and there are elements of that were very radical, but they never said, you know, there were never massive open carry rallies where people took their guns and said, you know, we should be getting ready for a bloody battle with the government. As I've seen, I've gone to some of these open carry rallies, and I've gone to other conservative conferences where they've told attendees that Obama's like Hitler, buy a gun because, you know, unlike the Jews, this time you can be prepared when they come after you. I mean, it's insane rhetoric, and we posted on the web, and a lot of people comment and say this is just crazy, this is crazy, but this is real, and it has real repercussions.
Yeah, it's like I've said, it's that dog whistle politic. They're speaking the code words that a certain segment of their base needs to hear, and it's, you know, like the activation words.
Sure, and if you actually, and here's the thing that I think it's crucial to realize when it's not only mentally ill people. Even if you're a rational person, even if you're not, you know, sick in the head like Jared Loughner was, if you truly believe that Obama creating passing health reform is like Hitler starting the Holocaust, like a lot of these Tea Party groups say on a regular basis, then you should take up arms and fight him, right? I mean, if you're a responsible, patriotic American, you should take up arms and you know, revolt against the government if he's starting another Holocaust. It's just so divorced from politics, or divorced from reality, pardon me. And again, there's a structural reason, because these lobbyists can't say, you know what, our only plan really is, and these Republicans, they can't go out and say, you know, we want tax cuts for the rich. We want to deregulate the health insurance system even more. They have to use these emotional arguments like socialism and communism and fascism, because they don't want to honestly tell people what they want to do, right, or why they oppose Obama's policies. They have to use these charged emotional arguments.
So what's the answer to this? You know, I had a friend tell me yesterday, well, what we need is we need to go back to the fairness doctrine, so you can have both sides, you know, presenting their message. I've had a bunch of ideas that, you know, folks have floated my way. I'm curious, is there a way back, or are we headed toward, as my one listener likes to say, towards the French Revolution?
You know, I think that's the trillion-dollar question. I don't know. I think media diversity and fairness would be important, but that's probably just impossible at this point. I think a more realistic goal would just be media diversity. I mean, net neutrality is incredibly crucial, so you can at least have some honest news outlets and, you know, people starting their own fair and accurate investigative research or radio show hosts online themselves. That's crucial. So we don't have corporate control of all of our media. Just in the next month or so, the FCC is set to approve or disapprove of the big merger between Comcast and NBC. You know, one of the only you know, sane media outlets on cable news, MSNBC, might be bought by Comcast, a very right-wing corporation, in just the next month.
Yeah.
So that's a critical issue, and I think progressives need to stand up on.
You know, but, you know, I look back at this, and, you know, a lot of my lefty friends are going, look, you know, the guy who's doing all this stuff to us is our guy. You know, the people who are, you know, this stuff's happening under our guy's watch, meaning President Obama. I mean, we're talking about a South Korean free trade agreement. We're talking about, you know, this taking away net neutrality. It's our guy doing it.
No, absolutely. And people, I mean, you know, I think I heard that, you know, I don't know too much about it, so I can't speak authoritatively, but I heard of this coffee party idea as this kind of left-wing alternative to the Tea Party. I think, from what I know, it doesn't seem to work. I mean, I think people need to be out in the streets, be much more vocal, be much more energized, because, you know, it's fine to sit around and sip coffee and talk about things, but people need to act.
And that's the other part of this. You know, a friend of mine said, you know, we could be heading towards this clash, if you will, and the left is horribly unprepared because they don't have any guns.
That's not true. I don't have any guns either. So, you know, that's kind of the darker side to, you know, predicting the future going forward. You know, I'm at a loss for words, because, you know, I hope and pray we don't come to that.
Oh, I hope and pray as well. But if the you know, the puppet masters have their will, there's part of me that thinks that's, I go back to the old Jay Gould quote, I could easily pay half the working class to kill the other half. I think we're starting to see some of that.
Well, here's I think the crazy thing, I've heard a couple other, but this isn't my idea, this is someone else that just pointed out to me the other day. Big manufacturing executives from the National Association of Manufacturers, even Koch's father, Fred Koch, funded the John Birch Society in the 60s to create chaos, yep, and to basically destabilize the Great Society, Lyndon Johnson, Kennedy, what have you. And then from the aftermath of that, the corporate candidate, Richard Nixon, looked moderate, even though he was as right as you could get, at least during that time period. So in contrast to the crazies of the Birch Society and all the segregation protests in the South, Nixon look like the moderate. And I think coming out of the Tea Party craziness that we're seeing now, someone who's very pro-corporate, very friendly to the supply-siders, like Mitt Romney. is going to look moderate in 2 years, you know? So, you know, that, not that this is a silver lining at all, but this might be part of the larger plan, because the same right-wing forces are funding the crazy, paranoid Tea Party protests all over the country.
They surely have deep pockets. But, you know, we're going to keep an eye on this. Lee, I appreciate the work you guys are doing over there at the Center for American Progress, the website AmericanProgress.org. I appreciate you coming on the program and talking to us about this.
Rick, thanks. Thank you so much for having me, and I apologize if I had some technical difficulties earlier. So.
No worries. Thanks so much, buddy. We're going to take a quick break. Back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
The steel strike of 1919 was called the Hunky Strike because most of the workers were either first or second generation immigrants from Eastern and Central Europe. Up until the end of World War I, workers had benefited from shorter hours, better pay, and the promise of union recognition. Once the war came to an end, the mill owners pursued anti-union open shop policies and other cost-cutting measures. During the strike, there was near total suppression of all civil liberties. Major work issues included the 12-hour day, the 7-day work week, scores of workers being injured and maimed, union recognition, and poverty wages. Mary Harris, better known as Mother Jones, fought tirelessly throughout her life for social justice and human rights as a labor leader and a worker advocate. On August 20th, while visiting striking miners in Homestead, Pennsylvania, home of U.S. Steel's famous Homestead Steelworks, she defied injunctions against public gatherings and addressed 5,000 striking workers and their families. This speech led to her being arrested and jailed for giving an unauthorized speech. When brought before the judge, she was asked who had signed a permit to speak at a public gathering. She answered, Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams. As the strike went on, Mother Jones, the grandmother of all agitators, gave many speeches to rally the workers. One speech in Chicago was described by a spy for the U.S. War Department's Military Intelligence Division as the foulest and most profane that can be imagined, teeming with ultra-radical suggestions. Welcoming the spies, she would invite them to the front of the crowd so they could report her words accurately. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by Grafton Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
AFSCME, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds. Don't you know?
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show. Progressive talk with a conscience.
While there's coming in the world, there are lines. Crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation. Wasting time in the unemployment lines.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you want to email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. All of our friends who are listening via podcast, I do appreciate your input. So you can email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. A poem was sent to me today from the Hobo's Horn book, written by George Milburn. It's called The Two Bums. And I thought, you know, kind of spot on for our time right now. It goes, "The bum on the rods is hunted down as an enemy of mankind. The other is driven round to his club, is feted, wined and dined. And they who curse the bum on the rods as the excess of the essence that all is bad will greet the other with a willing smile and extend a hand so glad. The bum on the rods is a social flea who gets an occasional bite, but the bum on the plush is a social leech blood-sucking day and night. The bum on the rods is a load so light his weight is scarcely felt. But it takes the labor of dozens of folks to furnish the other a meal. As long as we sanction the bum on the plush, the other will always be there. But rid ourselves of the bum on the plush, and the other will disappear. Then make an intelligent, organized kick. Get rid of the weights that crush. Don't worry about the bum on the rods. Get rid of the bum on the plush." And, you know, I read those words and I think about, you know, how we've seen the wealth in this country divided between those who have so much and those folks who are struggling to make just an existence in this country. And I look at this kid that, you know, did this shooting. 6 months he was looking for a job. Some of the reports that I had seen, he was reaching out to fellow gamers and crazy people online who basically mocked him. You know, we don't deal well with mental illness. And, you know, you stop and you think about all the money that has been diverted away from helping. You know, here in the state of Pennsylvania, Jake, you know, they did away with the state mental health facilities. Where'd those people end up? Most of them ended up on the streets, even though, you know, they'll fight vehemently to say, "Oh, no, we dealt with them." Yeah, you dealt with them out on the streets.
Some of them wound up in prison, but then again, the prison industry is a big business, isn't it?
Very, very big business. So our friends over at the Too Much Online blog, they asked the question, can overdosing on luxury fry our brains? Analysts from the Harvard Business School and the London Business School haven't found much frying, but their research has found that living luxuriously can profoundly impact our psyche. Business executives who bequeath themselves expensive office facilities and luxurious corporate jets, according to their research, seem to have a higher tendency to endorse self-interested decisions that might potentially harm others. Harvard's Roy Chow sees several possible reasons why luxury may prime people to behave less considerately. Exposure to luxury, according to the report, may activate a social norm that encourages going beyond a basic comfort level, even at the expense of others. Exposure to luxury may also directly increase people's personal desire, causing them to focus on their own benefit in the process, prioritizing profits over social responsibilities. And for me, you know, when you read through that, you go, you know, to be honest, what we should be looking at, how do we make this a more equal, more egalitarian society? How do we make sure that the services that folks need are there? You look at Pennsylvania. We're talking about some pretty deep, painful cuts coming down the road if the governor and the Republicans who control both houses of our legislature get their way. Now, I point to the story in Illinois, where they have approved, the big headline, Illinois legislators approve 66% tax increase. New York Times writes, hours after Illinois lawmakers chose a major tax rate increase to ease the state's desperate budget crisis, divisions over the approach grew wider on Wednesday. Patrick Quinn, the Democratic governor, praised the decision to raise the income tax rate by about 66% as necessary to avert the state's financial emergency, which includes a budget deficit of more than $13 billion. About $8 billion in unpaid bills to social service agencies and others, and a sinking bond rating. He said our state was careening towards bankruptcy and fiscal insolvency, and that, you know, hey, this was a good thing. You know, here's what, you know, maybe I don't think most people get. The government can't go bankrupt. The government has the ability to tax. So if you have the ability to raise revenue, you can't possibly go bankrupt. And I don't think our bankruptcy laws are going to allow that to happen. Now, understand, they've got the ability to tax you and me. So you and me had better get our heads out of our proverbial keisters and awaken to the reality that the revenue needs to be raised. So by talking about, hey, you know, we need to raise some revenue, maybe raising taxes is not a bad idea on the people who have it. Now, the article goes on to say in places like Wisconsin, which is right next door, Scott Walker, the Republican governor there, promptly issued a call to the Illinois businesses, which are going to face this tax of about 46%. And, you know, it's like they said, it's an old tourism quote, escape to Wisconsin. What I would ask is, can we escape the beggar thy neighbor economic race to the bottom and cut and throat policies that the Republican brought us? Can we stop that? Now, under the legislation, now you get the big headline, 66%, Jake, 66% increase. It goes from 3% up to 5%. So you're talking about an increase there. The business taxes go from 4.8 to 7%. And, you know, I see that. I wonder if it's going to be like Pennsylvania where nobody pays the corporate net income tax at all anyway. So kind of makes you wonder. But here's the thing. At some point, you're going to have to raise revenue. And here in the state of Pennsylvania, we're going to have to come to grips with this, because early indications from the people that I've talked to who are, you know, they've got their ear to the door of the transition teams, are saying there's no low-lying fruit. There's no office off onto the wing of waste, fraud, and abuse. In fact, they're saying that even the moderately high fruit isn't reachable without deep and painful cuts. Now, the measure in Illinois passed 60 to 57 in their House, 30 to 29 in their Senate, and surprise, surprise, not one Republican voted for it. That's what we're going to see here in this state. But the Republicans are going to control all of this stuff. So what does it mean? It means trouble.
That means one of two things. It means he's going to have to go back on his pledge.
He's not.
Not to raise taxes. Well, then the only thing left is to take draconian cuts in social net programs.
It's auction time, baby.
Shame on us. And that's another, wow, these are politicians. And that's one of the reasons they're going after the liquor stores, and they're even, you know, God help us, they're even talking about leasing the turnpike, which would be a major mistake.
Yeah. Anyway, when we come back, I want to talk about the cross-border trucking issue. Because, you know, the president and his Republican secretary of the Department of Transportation floating an idea to get the border opened up. We're going to talk with Todd Spencer. He's the executive vice president of the Owner Operators Independent Drivers Association, OOIDA. .org is their website. We're going to talk to him about how is this going to affect you guys driving up and down the highway. How's it going to affect the truckload carriers? How's it going to affect the drivers in this country? What does it mean to the manufacturers? What does it mean to the warehouse people? There's some stuff here. So we take a quick break. We're right back after this. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. 17,000 nurses have a new tentative labor contract agreement with Kaiser Permanente in California. The California Nurses Association, National Nurses United, says the tentative agreement covers 21 hospitals and 40 medical offices across Northern and Central California. The union says more than 20 important professional and economic enhancements were achieved
but further details aren't being released until the nurses have a chance to vote on approval of that contract. The California Nurses Association says the achievements were possible in a state with a minimum nurse-to-patient ratio law. CNANU says it's very pleased to recommend that its members approve this contract because it protects patients and defends hard-fought economic and practice standards. The San Francisco Labor Council is supporting WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, and Bradley Manning. In a resolution passed by the Labor Council, it opposed efforts by the U.S. and other governments to criminalize, financially destroy, and shut down WikiLeaks. The San Francisco Labor Council says documents exposed by WikiLeaks have exposed the criminal record of the U.S. government in violating international agreements and committing war crimes against people throughout the world. In its resolution, the Labor Council urged other unions to publicly affirm and defend freedom of the press and the ability to expose and criticize government wrongdoing. For the first time since reality television became regular content, a union has won the right to organize writers and producers. Jesse Russell reports.
Being non-union is no longer a fantasy for 100 writers and producers of reality television shows from Atlas Media and ITV Studios. The Writers Guild of America East has been in a long, ongoing battle to win the right to represent reality television show writers. Reality television is still a new industry, and show production companies have been hesitant to label the writers the same way they would label writers for fiction shows. Unions seeking to organize such workers have argued that the producers and writers of these shows essentially create a narrative out of the sometimes thousands of hours of footage. The Guild will now enter negotiations with Atlas. ITV is appealing their election results. The next target for the Guild is Lion TV, which has 85 writers. Lion TV produces the mid-afternoon hit show, Cash Cab.
Job discrimination claims are substantially up, according to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. The EEOC said last year saw the most complaints in the organization's 45 years. The commission saw 100,000 new complaints and resolved a record 104,999 private sector claims. As a result of the claims, employers paid out $404 million to workers who alleged they were discriminated against at the workplace. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIND, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. You know, I look at this cross-border trucking issue, and it's one of the things that for years now I've been railing against. I think it's a bad idea at any time, not just in the midst of the worst economic crisis in my lifetime, but I think at any time. Anytime you can import exploitable labor, that's a bad thing. And especially now when the trucking industry struggling, the freight tonnage is down. People are struggling to make ends meet. Now we're talking about a massive influx of cheaper labor. And in my opinion, the first folks who are going to go are the owner-operators. The guy who, you know, he owns one, two trucks, and he's out there on the road struggling to make ends meet. I've got Todd Spencer. He's an executive vice president of the Owner-Operators Independent Drivers Association. Todd, welcome to the program.
Hey, glad to be part of the show, Rick.
You know, I'm looking at this issue and angry. I was angry when Bush did it. I'm angry that they're trying to do it now. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Oh, it doesn't make sense. And obviously, as you mentioned, it's an issue that just doesn't seem to want to ever go away. This goes all the way back. I mean, this is a battle that we've been fighting for a decade.
And here's the thing. Once you open that door, you can't close it.
Oh, no. No. And, you know, actually, Congress recognized a long time ago there were problems with the southern border, with trucks crossing the border. NAFTA was about trade. It wasn't about trucks. The only real mention in that was the countries would harmonize their regulations. But at the time, obviously, there wasn't any awareness of the limitations and I guess really just how primitive this kind of safety systems were in Mexico.
So let me ask you this. You know, I've been saying that the number one person who's on the chopping block are probably your people. As a Teamster member for years, as a supporter of organized labor, I don't know that organized labor really has an initial dog in this fight, because I don't think that their drivers are going to be harmed. I think your guys are going to be the first to go.
Well, actually, this pretty much affects a pretty broad cross-section of trucking. While Teamsters are not nearly as prevalent in trucking now as they were, say, 25 years ago, they still recognize that, they still recognize when, if the ability to insource, in essence, foreign labor is there, trucking companies will capitalize on it. And there aren't really all that many union trucking companies left. So, you know, they are threatened by everything. But,
well, they're concentrated in the less than truckload sector, as where I'm sure most of you folks are truckload haulers.
Oh, yeah, truckload haulers. So but this is an industry that changes, and obviously, motor carrier management is always looking for cheaper and cheaper and cheaper labor. They don't really care where it comes from.
And that's the problem. I mean, and, you know, we hear, you know, with what happened on Saturday with the shooting of the congresswoman and all the heated rhetoric that's coming around it. I can't imagine, and to me this is a massive safety thing. I can't imagine what would happen to the powder keg that would explode if we were to open that border and you saw a mass influx of folks rolling into this country.
The safety issues never really go away. There's really no way to do any kind of a meaningful background check or driver license check or any of that stuff in Mexico because, one, the systems really aren't there in most instances, and generally information isn't even captured. So none of these things were ever a priority.
And we spent a whole lot of money. If I remember the Bush pilot program, you can help me if I'm wrong here. We the taxpayers, spent about $500 million so that two or three trucks.
$500 million. We've been spending money in Mexico to try to help them come up with commercial vehicle safety programs going back to the Clinton administration. And, you know, this is an effort, when I say the issue won't go away, but the issue never gets any better either.
Right. It just keeps getting kicked down the road. And what I've been saying all along is we need to renegotiate. We need to go back and say, look, it's just never going to happen. It took the European Union 50 years, and they're still not completely borderless when it comes to their trucking. It took them 50 years. I don't ever see this being something that, at least not in my lifetime, that's ever going to happen, because this is a one-way agreement. This is Mexican drivers coming into the U.S. I don't see any of your – maybe you do different polling, do you think any of your members would be willing to go into Mexico with their equipment?
At one time, but no, not in recent years. We had a member that actually used to drive in Mexico. He actually lived in Belize, and he would haul goods down to Belize from California.
Wow.
And his last trip, his truck got stopped by sort of customs. They held it for 8 months. 8 months.
Wow.
And there was no power that we could get with him anywhere in the U.S. that could actually get the Mexican government or those that had it to relent. They just kept it until they were darn good and ready, and then they let it go. And I'd have to say he's a lucky one.
Yeah, I've heard stories of people who, you know, and one time I went to Mexico, rented a car, kind of dumb on my part, and went driving around, and someone that I got back told me about something called the morbido, or the little bite.
The bite.
Which means they pull you over and they just extort money out of you.
Yeah, well, you know, that's been commonplace for years, but obviously the tolls or the bites have become much, much larger now, when basically crime is really the biggest industry in the country. But there has been efforts in the previous Congress to actually take another look at this issue. Basically, the most vocal and active person in the House of Representatives is U.S. Congressman Peter DeFazio.
Morgan.
He led a letter campaign that signed on, that had 72 members of the Congress sign on to it, to push our trade representatives and the Obama administration to renegotiate the specific provision in NAFTA that authorizes this trucking stuff, that would just simply pull that provision back out. 72 members of Congress signed it. That initiative is still there. I mean, it will survive into this Congress, and we're certainly asking all lawmakers to sign on to that initiative to repeal the specific provision and annex on trucking.
You know, and one of the others that I've been talking about is this is, you know, a job-destroying bill. This is a job-destroying idea because it's not just the trucking industry. And this is where I want, you know, people who work in warehouses, people who work in manufacturing to understand it's just not about the truck driver driving up and down the road. It's about a whole swath of industries that, quite frankly, we could lose.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, you know, there seems to be little minimal interest on the part of most trucking companies or what we call motor carriers in Mexico. I mean, there's not really much interest in the overall. When they had this pilot program growing previously, they set up to 100 trucking companies could participate. Only about 17 actually did. That's out of the whole country. So there isn't a whole lot of interest from this particular niche. I can tell you there's no interest on their part in having U.S. trucks come south of the border. They recognize they can be taken advantage of, too, by bigger economic interests. But the big pushers for this inside the U.S. are the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and some of their bigger members that see an economic gain from themselves from doing this. And basically, they pretty much are the same Chamber of Commerce for Mexico. So these are the folks that are leaning on lawmakers, basically really, really twisting arms, you know. The latest tactic in this last election was pointing out that tariffs that Mexico applies to various goods are costing the U.S. jobs and pointing the fingers at U.S. lawmakers and say, you've got to get rid of these tariffs by allowing Mexican trucks to come up here or you're killing jobs in our state.
Yeah, the potatoes in Washington, the grapes in California.
Yeah, I mean, ridiculous stuff.
Yeah. But let me ask you this, because I think the system as it's being done right now works. I think that, you know, you have Mexican drivers who bring it into an area, they drop it off, American drivers pick it up, take it from there. Seems pretty rational to me.
They've been doing it that way for years and years and years, and it really isn't nearly as archaic as how it's generally proponents of opening the border describe it. Most of the goods that come now simply it's drop and hook with a trailer. There'll be a Mexican company that deals business regularly with a U.S. company, and they just swap trailers.
Let me ask you, maybe if you know, how many of the companies in Mexico are owned by U.S. interests? Because one of the things that I've heard is that, you know, most of this is being fueled by the big U.S. carriers, that they've got subsidiaries in Mexico who are just dying to interline as we move forward.
Well, until NAFTA actually went through, there were provisions in Mexican law that said U.S. interests could not own a majority interest of any of these types of businesses in Mexico, or at least legally. After NAFTA went through, actually as far back as 2000, I think the provisions were that each country could have 100% interest in a company in each other's country. So, yeah, that certainly is a benefit to them.
Yeah, you said earlier that
many big truckload carriers in the U.S. have Mexican sister companies or subsidiary companies, and realistically, they're sort of faunching at the bit to be able to bring those trucks and those drivers up to operate in the U.S.
Yeah. You know, here's what bothers me about this. All of the things that I've seen in the proposal so far are going to cost me, as a taxpayer, a lot of money so that the companies can benefit from lower wages, because that's really why the Chamber of Commerce is pushing this. It's more profit due to lower wages. So I'm going to have to spend a bunch of money to make sure that Mexican drivers have CDLs, can speak English, take drug tests, the things that American drivers have to do. I'm going to have to pay for that as a taxpayer.
Well, and claims and accidents and all of the other ramifications that come about, if they have accidents, you know they're going to get treated in our hospitals, and there's not going to be any payment for them to the extent that these people get paid for driving the trucks. They're not going to get paid in U.S. dollars that are going to stay in the U.S. They're going to get paid in whatever the currency is. They may get paid in U.S. dollars, but those dollars will go back to Mexico.
Yeah, I'm saying they're going to get paid in TA credits.
Well,
they're just going to get a little TA card, and they'll be able to eat and shower to their heart's content, and there won't be any money changing hands.
Well, I guess that's a possibility, too, because, you know, basically in trucking, lots and lots of American citizens are taking advantage of. This is a very, very tough industry that works people very, very hard, and the rewards really aren't very good.
which if I can go back to what we were talking about earlier, which is why I say we should be organizing these things, and groups like yours should be pushing for rates that are going to be fair. I see the cheap freight stickers on a lot of trucks, and no cheap freight stickers, but I don't see a lot of movement towards organizing those folks.
Well, the problem is trucking was deregulated in 1980, and basically
when they deregulated that, they
threw every bit of fairness or anything like that away. And what happened is trucking companies generally switched from privately owned companies that basically did think about the future to publicly owned stock companies that really don't think beyond the next quarter's report.
Oh, boy, do I know that.
Making short-term returns to investors, and all investors, realistically, and investors probably don't really know much about most of the things they invest their money in, but they're just interested in maximum return, and you cut labor costs, that means a bigger return to shareholders, and that's where trucking went, and I don't know if we'll survive deregulation at all.
Yeah, and maybe the end game was always opening up the border. Let me add, last question I've got for you as we move forward with this. What should people be doing? Because I'm telling people they got to call their representatives. They've got to write letters to the editors. They've got to do the things to get the message out, because this can't be one of those things pet in the dark of night.
Oh, no. And it won't be. And absolutely, you are passing along the correct message. Call your lawmakers. Call your senators. Write letters to the newspapers. This is a really, really dumb idea that needs to be put to bed for good.
Well, I guess that wasn't the last question. Let me ask one more. And this goes to a unity thing. You know, you guys are obviously an independent drivers association. You have a lot of members. Would there be any talk of, like we see in other countries, where, you know, you see trucks turn sideways on the highway?
Well, Rick, that's actually how our organization started all the way back in 1973. There actually were trucks turned sideways across the road. And ironically, my friend, it happened in Pennsylvania. And I would suspect there are still old truckers around in PA and Ohio that participated in that. Is something like that likely to happen again? I'd say probably not. Not so much that the guys aren't willing, but, we were a much more innocent, younger nation then. A lot of the stuff that drivers did wasn't even illegal then. And it all is now.
Yeah, they've really. I drove for 18 years for Roadway Express, so I got a pretty good idea what's going on there.
Uh-huh.
Sad. Todd, I appreciate your time, and I hope you guys fight this.
All right, Rick. Well, I'm glad to be part of the show, and I think it's a great one. And by all means, pass the word, friend.
All right. We'd love to have you back again real soon. Thanks so much, Todd.
All right.
Todd Spencer from the owner-operators, the Owner-Operator Independent Drivers Association, OOIDA.com is the website. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
In response to Tea Party agitation, the new Republican leaders in the House have been strutting around as reformers, coming across as suit and tie versions of that guy on the TV show, Dirty Jobs. "We're going to clean up the place," they exclaim, starting with that big legislative stain called earmarks. No more secret diversions of taxpayers' money into lawmakers' pet pork barrel projects, decreed the new House Speaker, John Boehner. Posing as a reborn Mr. Clean, Boehner fairly sparkled at a press conference to announce that he was banning earmarks. So that's that. Mission accomplished, right? No. What the GOP has done is simply sweep earmarks under the rug. Take Senator Mark Stephen Kirk, for example. The Illinois Republican was a scathing critic of earmarks last year, even as he used his position on the Appropriations Committee to force the Education Department to funnel more than $1 million of stimulus money into an Illinois school district. Sounds like an earmark, doesn't it? But technically it wasn't. Rather than directing the money to Illinois by way of the appropriations bill, he did it by way of a letter to the department. This is known to insiders like Kirk as letter marking. There's also phone marking, where the dirty deed is done by a phone call from a legislator to an agency head. Another slick move called account marking happens when a member pads the budget of a particular agency, then demands that the extra funds be spent on the member's special project. All of these slick tricks add up to billions of tax dollars every year. This is Jim Hightower saying, Mr. Clean wants our applause for a change that is nothing but a deceit. In an act of raw hypocrisy, Boehner has changed the name of the earmark game, but the scam remains the same. Now, think about it. That really is a dirty job, isn't it?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.com.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
You know, that 40-hour week seems to be getting longer and longer for most people. We seem to be working longer and harder for less. And you look at the American trucking industry. While that interview may have been a little inside baseball, the reality is it's about jobs. You know, the guys who drive trucks, you know, whether you like truck drivers driving around or not, the reality is these guys work 70, 80 hours a week. Especially when you look at the new Bush laws for hours of service, which I was completely against. Another example of just really a lack of caring about family values. And I know the folks love to tout family values. This not so good. But this issue. Once we open that border and you say, okay, let them roll right on through. What are you looking at? First thing we're looking at a boatload of money and oversight, making sure that the drivers that are coming here have licenses, they're not criminals, they're who they say they are, having this database that no one has. It's not there. Making sure that the equipment that they're driving is up to par with our equipment. And that's kind of at times can be a specious argument, because you know what? I do believe when this is open, the American companies will completely buy up all of the Mexican trucking companies, and they will have new equipment. But for right now, that's not the case. So how much does it cost us? How much does it cost us to monitor the things that are coming across? You look at the containers that are coming into the country. We're inspecting, from what I've heard, somewhere between 1% to 5%. What if that were the thousands of trucks that would become rolling across the border every day? You look at the auto industry, and they're talking about a good chunk of our auto industry, $42 billion a year that we import more than we export to Mexico. You know, you stop and you look at all of this stuff. We're talking about giving more jobs away. And, you know, at the end of this, we should be figuring out how to make sure that our industries are secure. And when you start losing the jobs like the trucking industry, I mean, my grandfather, back after World War II, came home to living in a car, thanks to the fact that he got a decent job, a union job. My grandmother and grandfather, they lived a solidly working middle class life. What happens when those jobs go away? When you're now insourcing these Mexican drivers who are making somewhere between 10 and 13 cents a mile, when the industry standard here is about 41 cents or a dollar a mile for owner operators last time I checked. What happens? What happens when those jobs go away? Do you think the rates are going to come down? Do you think that the prices we're going to pay at the shelf are going to come down? Absolutely not. That just means more profit, more money into the pockets of the ownership class. You and I, we don't benefit from this stuff. And part of why I think it's so important to talk about this stuff is
Yeah, there is a class war going on. And that's not heated rhetoric. That's reality. We're the ones being robbed on a daily basis. Our labor is not being compensated. Why? Because we're divided. And I look at the owner-operators association there. Those are, you know, they're trying to bring those people together, but at the end of the day, you've got a whole bunch of individuals pursuing their own thing. And I don't know that you're going to ever see the kind of unity that it would take to turn the truck sideways on the road and shut this country down. I just don't think it's possible.
I tend to agree with you, Rick. You don't have the organization that those of us in the labor movement do. You don't have the educational structure. I don't know how loose this organization is, but I doubt that it's very well funded. You know, my hat's off to the guy for making an effort, and I'm sure he's done some good, but wow, he's climbing a big mountain.
And, you know, he's right. I mean, the Chamber of Commerce, who, you know, I happened to watch a thing on C-SPAN last night when I got home from the show. They were touting how they have their chapters in India and how they're sending jobs and business and investment to India and how they're, you know, going around the globe and they're making sure that investment is everywhere else. And it was really almost surreal that I'm sitting here listening to someone who's talking about destroying this country and saying, well, you know, the only way that we can compete is if we do away with our environmental regulations, if we do away with our tax code, if we do away with any restriction and just let business do whatever it wants to do.
And yet these people are the real movers and shakers. You know, we decry jobs leaving the country. We decry the economic conditions. When was the last time you heard a politician really addressing that issue? And what the, I've heard it once or twice, but only mentioned, and that was it. There was no in-depth discussion. But these are the things that we should be addressing. We should be pounding these people. But yet I don't hear it.
Yep. Part of what we need to do. But I encourage everyone, you've got to call your representative. You've got to write letters to the editor. You've got to get involved in this issue. Because again, you know, and look, this is, I'll be honest, this is my guy. You know, this is the guy I voted for doing this. And he's got to hear from all of us. And not in a way that, you know, no. Say, look, this is bad for us no matter what we do. And it's bad for the drivers coming into this country because I fear for their safety. I do. Because I remember the Greyhound bus strikes. I remember a lot of the turmoil that went on around that and what I foresee with this. Troubling stuff. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Erwin Aronson, our good friend and attorney, we're going to talk about the Corbett administration, some of the things that are on the horizon. 1-888-520-RICK. We're right back after this.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
We keep South Central Pennsylvania wired. We are the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 143, right here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And for 93 years, we have proudly provided our contractors and their customers with the highest skilled and best educated electricians in the industry. Whether it's wiring a light socket in a Habitat for Humanity's home or replacing a vital component on a nuclear reactor, our professional electricians do the job right the first time. Our members are the backbone of our community and our nation, working to make tomorrow a brighter day. If you want to join us, or if you need an electrician for your industrial or commercial project, call us at 717-232-7093 or visit our website at www.idwlocal143.org. We are the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 143, and we keep South Central Pennsylvania wired.
Always by your side.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves up not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Exposing GOP hypocrisy. The Rick Smith Show.
If you want to be, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Reports have it that the Corbett team is ordering all Commonwealth agencies to remove all news releases from their websites and to purge the governor, Governor Rendell's name entirely from all agency websites by 11 a.m. on Tuesday. Reports are that the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources will see its entire history swept away. So the last 8 years gone. And I guess the question I have then is that a sign of things to come for the what we're about to see? I've got our good friend Erwin Aronson on the line. I'll talk a little bit about that. Erwin, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, good to talk to you, Rick.
You know, I'm looking at some of the things that may be coming down the road. I've heard talk of, you know, right-to-work laws. I've heard talk of privatizing the state stores. A lot of this really, really bad stuff for the state.
Well, there certainly seems to be quite the agenda. And the thread that seems to bind this agenda together is how can the government of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania be used to hurt working people, strip them of their rights, take away their dignity and strip them in every possible way of decency. It sure sounds like a real low road campaign.
You know, I've been hearing this, oh, Pennsylvania needs to be a right to work state. You see in Indiana, Governor Daniels there saying, the only way, Indiana is going to be able to compete is to become a right to work state. And people hear this, and they, one, I don't think they understand what right to work legislation is. And two, you know, who could possibly be against the right to work?
Well, that would be wonderful if this so-called hocus pocus right to work stuff conferred any rights on anybody. But once we get past the sloganeering, right to work doesn't give anybody any right to do anything except have their rights at work stripped from them and have their voice taken away from them through this really sick, fundamentally anti-American approach. It's fundamentally anti-American because what it's saying is the government, in this case, state of Pennsylvania, or maybe in the Mitch Daniels fantasy land of Indiana, the government would pass a law that says an employer and a union who sit down together and agree on things would be prohibited as a matter of law from agreeing on certain conditions, particular conditions. That's not a right to work, that's a right to wreck.
But getting the government involved in this, isn't this the antithesis of what most of the people who are pushing this should be standing for, or at least what they're telling us?
Well, I don't know what they should be standing for or shouldn't be standing for. I've long since passed the time of my life when I could tell people what they ought to be standing for. But I can tell you, without any fear of contradiction, that the people who are advocating this are advocating government interference in private contracts. These are exactly the people that are telling us we've got to get the government off our back, that we've got to deregulate, that we need to make government smaller. And here they are advocating a program, this so-called right-to-wreck crap, that gets government off the sidelines and right at the bargaining table, right down at the nitty-gritty, and says to an employer and a union that even though they want to agree to something, the law will keep them from doing it. We're going to put you in jail if you agree to do something that everybody says we can do.
Is that reality in the right to work states? I mean, I got to be honest. I've never lived in a right to work state, so I'm not really sure what the law is there.
Well, right, reality in a right to work state is that if a union and employer sit down at a bargaining table and say that because the law in this country requires that a union, when it's certified as a bargaining representative, represents everybody at the workplace that's covered by the National Labor Relations Board determination of who's in a bargaining unit. Right-to-work law says that even though the union has a statutory, a legal, mandatory obligation to represent everybody over wages and hours and terms and conditions of employment, the company and the union together can't even agree that somebody who's the beneficiary of that would pay the union, reimburse the union, the cost of the representation.
So basically, they're basically just trying to starve the unions.
They're not trying to starve the unions. They're trying to crush the unions. And they crush the unions by saying that the law will step in and denude the union. It would be like neutering the union. It would be like sending the union to the spay and neuter clinic. Because as long as you have a law that stands in the way of people exercising the right to join a union, that law, by definition, imposes diminished conditions, and we see it. Look at this, the right-to-work states. Look at places like Mississippi and Arkansas, places like Oklahoma and Alabama. Everything that's supposed to be up is down, and everything's supposed to be down is up. Wages are down. Education access is down. Health care is down. Birth rates are down. There is such a direct correlation, Rick, between what happens to people's lives, the basics of living, when a right-to-work law is imposed and these so-called anti-government, make government smaller people, take government off the sidelines and put it right in the bargaining table in a way that denies the free negotiation of a contract, what happens is people's lives suffer. Kids suffer. Seniors suffer. Workers suffer. And ultimately, what it does is it puts and pits worker against worker in the same workplace because we have two classes of people. And we have two classes of people at the workplace because somebody in the government decided to enforce that, to impose it on us as a matter of law and shove it down our throats.
But somebody's got to benefit from this. I mean, everything you've said so far sounds horribly negative. Someone has to benefit.
Well, there's any number of people that benefit, but none of them look like workers. The bosses benefit because as soon as they divide people up, they can start to cut and slash and deny and take away. The politicians who are telling us all about how they want less government while they're voting for more government benefit because since we had this Citizens United case decided a year ago, that allows corporations to just literally raid the corporate treasury and pass it right along to politicians, keep passing out money to these phony pals who tell us one thing and do something else. They tell us that they want to make government smaller, that there's too much government, government's too big, government's too expensive. Then they want to propose to vote, like Mitch Daniels announces, that we can't negotiate freely our collective bargaining agreements with employers who agree with us on terms and conditions. It's nuts. But what's really nuts is for the first time in nearly 40 years, an incoming governor has announced, send one of those bills to me, I'll sign it.
Yeah, when I saw that, I got to be honest, it kind of took me back. And I during the campaign, they kind of quashed Cawley when he mentioned it at a Tea Party rally.
Well, you're talking about Cawley, the guy who's about to become the lieutenant governor of Pennsylvania.
Right, but I got to be honest, when I saw that, they quashed him in an awful hurry.
Yeah, well, there's the poetry of running for office and the prose of governing, and when the poetry wasn't rhyming, they shut him up.
Right.
But now that the election is over and they're looking at 4 years of power, the avarice of the power that seems to have inebriated them before being sworn in has them making statements like, send me one of them right-to-work laws and we'll get it signed for you. These are the same people, of course, who are saying, let's destroy public education by taking money out of the public schools, taking taxpayer dollars out of the public schools, and putting in the hands of the private schools that the rich kids go to. Or let's take that state store system, the wine and spirit shops, and shut them down and sell them off to private enterprise so the $300 million a year that the citizens of Pennsylvania benefit from their income will be taken away too, where we are right now, shareholders in a very successful corporation that cuts our taxes every day.
Yep, but the auctioneer will be in. Let's take a quick call. I got Mike on line one. How are we doing tonight, Mike?
Gentlemen, how you doing?
Good.
Good, Mike. How are you?
All right. I got some information today through a note somebody sent me from meetings in the Department of Health and other places. But basically, they're saying the new budget in the Commonwealth has to be done by March. The governor's side, and that it's all about cuts and how they're going to do those cuts. And I got the strangest thing today. For the first time today, I actually had a manager call me and ask if they had any rights at a disciplinary conference. Could they have anybody there to represent them? And I said, maybe a lawyer if you hire one, but other than that, no. There's some really scary stuff happening with the state government right now. And I don't think people understand that at a personal level what right to work means. What it means is they will do away with any obligation for people who are not directly members of the union to pay for what the union does. But what they also don't understand, there's already been Supreme Court ruling that says the union doesn't have to provide you any services if that's the case, any service. And so when you need representation or something like that, it won't be there. And I don't think they understand that. Also, what it means is that if the union's successful in negotiating a contract and you aren't a union member, that management doesn't have to include you in that. Or I should say the government entities don't, because management in the Commonwealth has already learned that they don't have to get what the union has got. They have all these years, so they really didn't care. But now, for almost 4 years, management in the Commonwealth has had no increases in salary at all. Nothing.
Let me ask Irwin, what do you think? What do you think about that, Irwin?
Well, I'm faced with a whole bunch of things there that Mike's talking about, and a number of them are very scary. First of all, one of the scary things about this right to work garbage poison is that while the union is compelled by law to represent everybody in the bargaining unit, the right to work law would prohibit the union from even being reimbursed the cost of that representation. So that's going to, by definition, diminish things. Here at the state level, people below the first level of supervision have a right to have a union. If they choose to have one, the union can, among other things, represent them in disciplinary hearings. People that are first-level supervisors, as a matter of law, have a right to something called meet and discuss, but that doesn't really mean a right to representation. That means that they can force their public sector employers to meet with them and discuss things, but ultimately no agreement has to be reached, and it's not an unfair practice for an employer just to refuse to bargain in good faith with respect to first-level supervisors and above. So, you know, there are real fundamental problems, and as we go down this road, there are rumors about a new budget. We know that there's somewhere between $3 and $5 billion shortfall between anticipated revenue and current obligations of the state. So with Governor-elect Corbett and right-to-work Lieutenant Governor Cawley announcing that they will oppose any taxes, new taxes, increases in existing taxes, even a tax on the extraction of natural resources from the land under Pennsylvania in the Marcellus Shale Field. The only way that this budget is going to come into balance, and unlike the federal government, state government as a matter of constitutional law in this state, Pennsylvania, has to be balanced. The only way to do that is by cutting and slashing and burning. So if I were a public employee, particularly at the state level, I would have some real basic and meaningful concerns as to what's happening with my job, and with my job, my capacity to feed my family, provide health care for my children, and plan for my retirement. So Mike's talking about a number of these issues, and they're all there, and they're whirling around right now in this period of uncertainty about what's going to happen, while it seems the high priority at the moment for the incoming administration is to engage in the Soviet Union-style purge of past history by eliminating any reference to the Rendell government. And to talk about these tangential things that strip people of their rights, like so-called right to work, while not facing the big issues of how are we going to feed people, how are we going to create jobs, how are we going to do the business of government, you know, the business of those things that people can't do for themselves.
Right. Does that answer it for you, Mike?
Well, one thing I wanted to point out, Rick, everybody needs to pay very close attention to the rhetoric. Right to work. Every slave on earth has a right to work.
Excellent point.
Well said, Mike.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much, Mike. Talk to you soon.
All right.
It's a good point, Irwin.
Well, you know, he reminds me of a lesson I learned when I was a high school student, and I had a high school teacher who talked about what is freedom. And she articulated a concept that the people in the United States of the 1700s through 1865 that lived in the South, who were of color and were slaves, were arguably the most free people of all, because all they had to do was wake up in the morning and go to work. Their shelter was provided for them. What food they ate was provided for them. Their clothing was provided to them. And all they needed to do was get up and go to work for massa every day, and they were free.
And there were actually some laws on the books on that you had to take to them as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But, the free workers didn't have any of those luxuries of
No, they had to fend for themselves.
It's an interesting kind of twist on things. So let me ask you, a lot of my friends are saying, well, it's never going to happen. But I'm telling some of my union friends, be very worried. Be very worried when your governor is saying, I'll sign it.
Well, I think that they should be more than worried. I think that it's time to get on the phones and get on the email and start communicating with their legislators, because what we have now is that Governor-elect Corbett has told us what he's going to do. If he gets a chance, he's going to sign it. So we got to do everything in our power in contacting members of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives and Pennsylvania State Senate, be they Democrats or Republicans, and let them know that we don't want them voting for laws that interfere with our right to bargain, that interfere with our employer's right to bargain, because the only way we can be sure that we're not facing the double-barreled gun of a right-to-wreck law is by making sure the legislature doesn't pass it, because the governor-elect has said if they do pass it and send it on to his desk, according to a press release from the Pennsylvanians for Right to Work, an organization that is funded by who knows what, because they don't ever announce or report or reveal who give them their money, but we got some good ideas for the Manufacturers Association and the Chamber of Business and Industry. But this governor has said, before he's even raised his right hand and put it on a Bible to take the oath of his office to uphold, protect, and defend our Constitution, he's already announced that he's ready to sign this law if the legislature passes it. So we got to do everything and anything, and right now, not soon, but right now, and start calling the offices of our State House and Senate members, visiting the offices of our State House and Senate members and their home offices. And we got to be sending them emails. And if they have children who ride the bus, I think that we ought to have a sign out asking the kids at the bus stop, why does your daddy or your mommy want to take away my capacity to earn a living and feed my family and send my kids to a good school like you go to?
Excellent. Excellent point, Irwin. Excellent point. That's why we're going to keep fighting this, and we're going to stay up on the issue. And we look forward to having you back next week.
I'll be happy to be there, and wish all of our listeners who are facing all of these really scary, unnerving, unbalancing things, and who are facing, of course,
the realities of the news that came out this weekend from the Western United States, from Arizona. Wish everybody a peaceful and safe new year and an opportunity to get back to work and to do the things we really need to do and maybe have our government do the business of the people instead of the business of the business.
Amen. Right there with you. Thanks so much, Erwin.
Thank you. Talk to you.
All right. Take care. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call them at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happy!
Standing tall against the multinational corporate agenda. The Rick Smith Show.
I wish they would have done that right from the beginning. Right from the beginning, past that. We'd have seen people flocking. Flocking, I tell you. Just like during the Depression. You had people in the worst economic time of the country flocking to your organizations to help secure their job site. It makes such sense. Today, back in 1876, novelist Jack London was born. He is credited with the classic definition of a scab, you know, someone who would cross a picket line and take another striker's job. He said, quote, after God had finished with the rattlesnake, the toad, the vampire, he had some awful substance left, which he made a scab. A scab is a two-legged animal with a corkscrew soul, a waterlogged brain, and a combination backbone of jelly and glue. Where others have hearts, he carries a tumor of rotten principles. I think that about does it. Sure. You know, as we move forward in this, you know, the whole discussion is going to be how do we go after those public sector workers? How do we go after those people who still have pensions? How do we go after the people who, pick up our trash and the people who answer the 911 calls? How do we go after the public sector workers? That's the argument here. That's what the right has pushed on us. And what's interesting, what we need to be talking about is combating that. You know, do the public sector workers have the Cadillac health care and the grand pensions? Do they make such grand wages over those in the private sector? Many reports say no. What do you say, Jake?
Well, I just happen to have a report here which says quite the opposite. Average wage earners, private sector, this is throughout the country, about $55,000. Public sector, about $49,000. Less than a high school education. Private, $29,000. Public, $24,000. With a high school diploma. Private sector, about $38,000. Public sector, about $36,000. With some college, it's $43,000 to $42,000. With an associate's degree, it's $47,000 to $45,000. With a bachelor's degree, it's $71,000 to $48,000. And as you notice here, Rick, as your educational level goes up, the difference between private and public becomes increasingly so, which is what our buddy Mike has often reiterated. Professional degree, listen to these numbers. The average wage in the private sector with a professional degree is about $152,000. Public sector, $88,000. That's a difference of about $44,000. Excuse me, $64,000. With a master's degree, average wage in the private sector, $93,000. Public, it's about $60,000. With a doctorate, average wage in the private sector is about $119,000. And in the public sector, about $88,000. Total compensation, the levels are pretty much about the same thing. In other words, on all categories, you work for the state, you work in the public sector, you're being compensated at a lower level. As your educational level increases, that difference is multiplied by several fold. So this nonsense, and I hear it all the time on the radio with the right-wing talk shows, that those people who work for government are overpaid, that they make too much, that their allegations all too often are that they actually make more. This disproves that. If you talk to somebody that works for the state, you know that's not true. But these statistics are pretty convincing as far as who makes more.
Well, you know, our right wing little girl has something to say on that.
You lie! You hate America!
That's right. You lie! See, that's what most people would say, most of my right-wing friends would say to those numbers. Ah, you're just making that up, Jake. You lie. And the reality is, look, you know, it's been that way for years. The people that actually get jobs working for the government, oh, I don't know, they're qualified. They're educated. They're people who, oh, I don't know, have some thought of public service. And this whole argument is frustrating on a number of levels because the big microphones are out there berating these folks.
Well, here's two factors that I didn't mention that I think are key. State and local employees are substantially more educated than their private sector counterparts. About 54% of state and local full-time employees hold a bachelor's degree compared to only about 35% in the private sector. Public sector employees receive more compensation in the form of benefits than private sector workers, which I've known for a long time. A lot of people tell you, well, you know, I don't make all that much. I work for the state, especially. I don't make all that much, but I have good benefits. That was true for some federal jobs, too. I know in my area where I lived, there were several federal agencies that employed a large number, and the same thing was true there.
Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. We're right back after this.
America for the better. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. 17,000 nurses have a new tentative labor contract agreement with Kaiser Permanente in California. The California Nurses Association, National Nurses United, says the tentative agreement covers 21 hospitals and 40 medical offices across Northern and Central California. The union says more than 20 important professional and economic enhancements were achieved, but further details aren't being released until the nurses have a chance to vote on approval of that contract. The California Nurses Association says the achievements were possible in a state with a minimum nurse-to-patient ratio law. The CNANNU says it's very pleased to recommend that its members approve this contract because it protects patients and defends hard-fought economic and practice standards. The San Francisco Labor Council is supporting WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, and Bradley Manning. In a resolution passed by the Labor Council, it opposed efforts by the U.S. and other governments to criminalize, financially destroy, and shut down WikiLeaks. The San Francisco Labor Council says documents exposed by WikiLeaks have exposed the criminal record of the U.S. government in violating international agreements and committing war crimes against people throughout the world. In its resolution, the Labor Council urged other unions to publicly affirm and defend freedom of the press and the ability to expose and criticize government wrongdoing. For the first time since reality television became regular content, a union has won the right to organize writers and producers. Jesse Russell reports.
Being non-union is no longer a fantasy for 100 writers and producers of reality television shows from Atlas Media and ITV Studios. The Writers Guild of America East has been in a long ongoing battle to win the right to represent reality television show writers. Reality television is still a new industry, and show production companies have been hesitant to label the writers the same way they would label writers for fiction shows. Unions seeking to organize such workers have argued that the producers and writers of these shows essentially create a narrative out of the sometimes thousands of hours of footage. The Guild will now enter negotiations with Atlas. ITV is appealing their election results. The next target for the Guild is Lion TV, which has 85 writers. Lion TV produces the mid-afternoon hit show, Cash Cab.
Job discrimination claims are substantially up, according to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. The EEOC said last year saw the most complaints in the organization's 45 years. The commission saw 100,000 new complaints and resolved a record 104,999 private sector claims. As a result of the claims, employers paid out $404 million to workers who alleged they were discriminated against at the workplace. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your working class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Work it hard to make a left. Bring shit from red. Father, son, let the cameo through dental. Head is big.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, for all the talk about earmarks, all the talk about, oh, we need to save money, three Republicans on the House Appropriations Subcommittee view the ban on earmarks as temporary, and they want to retain the power to direct spending for their districts. Idaho Republican Mike Simpson, Virginia Republican Frank Wolf, and Alabama Republican Robert Edholt don't really see the whole earmark thing as a ban. They just want to hold off on a little bit until the public's confidence can be restored in the process, which is you know, good luck on that. It's not going to happen. But, you know, they're kind of, you know, they ran on it. The rhetoric was, hey, we need to ban this. But now the backing away, which is kind of interesting, as we move forward. And, you know, as we know, the earmark ban has been, killed from the very beginning. But, you know, as I've said before, look, they're great at campaigning. They're great at sloganeering. Not so good at leading. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Helen on line one wanting to talk about the president's speech and the ceremony in Tucson. Helen, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I'm dying to see what the right-wing talk show hosts say tomorrow, because surprise, surprise, the blessing was given by a Native American, and he introduced himself explaining that his mother was from a Mexican-American family that had been in the area for, generations. I guess they were one of the people that came with the conquistadors or something.
Right.
And his father was a Yaqui Indian. And it was definitely a different sort of prayer, and I just cannot wait to hear what they have to say tomorrow.
Well, I mean, they're going to tear everything apart. And what was supposed to be something that draws us together, they're going to find a way to divide us.
It was amazing. I saw that guy Kyle.
John Kyle.
Yeah, he was there behind the president. I didn't see Flake, but that is his name.
Yeah, Jeff Flake, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't see him in the audience, but I saw Kyle there right behind the president. He was standing up. He's probably going to get reprimanded because he was standing up and clapping just as hard as everybody else.
Yeah, he wasn't at the big fundraiser in Maryland at the Harbor Club there that John Boehner had their fundraiser. But they were going to watch the speech on TV.
Yeah. Well, everybody should be listening to hear how they I hope they don't, but I have a terrible feeling that they're really going to be very disrespectful of the American Indian blessing.
Oh, come on. We know they will be. we'll see. I appreciate the call, Helen.
Sure.
Thanks so much. You're giving me the finger. You got something on your mind?
I was going to ask Helen. I don't know if she wants to call back. Since obviously we didn't see it, I was interested to know if the president stayed kind of above the fray and non-political. I know his advisors were a little bit concerned about that. This is the time to draw the country together. I was wondering what she thought about the performance of the president. Did he do that? I would tend to think that would be the way he would handle it. Bring people together instead of stoking the fires, keeping it as non-political as we can.
Well, I mean, as he said, at a time when our discourse has become so sharply polarized, at a time when we are far too eager to lay the blame for all that ails the world at the feet of those who think differently than we do, it's important for us to pause for a moment and make sure that we are talking with each other in a way that heals, not in a way that wounds. And it's kind of the old way I talked about last night. It's this, we need to be talking to each other, not at each other or past each other. Too often what you have this political discourse of people screaming at each other and no one hearing what the other person's saying. And, you can go back to that moment. And to me, that moment with Arlen Specter and that guy in Lebanon screaming at him was one of those turning points where people, it's my right to say whatever I want to say and be as uncivil and as rude and as ugly as the rest of the world thinks we are.
But that, the irony is I was about 20 feet away from that, but I believe of all the things that were said during that debate, that was probably as big a cheap shot as I've heard. I mean, these politicians just got bludgeoned, but what that man said to Arlen Specter, and God knows Arlen Specter is a tough politician, but he didn't deserve what was said to him that day. That was just way beyond the realm of reality.
Yeah, but what Lee Fong said earlier, what you got is you got people who were out there pushing these people, going, go ahead, go on, here's your talking points. Here's, there were a couple of scripts out there to take with you when you go, and how to confront your congressman, and how to, how to get them, how to have that gotcha moment. There was a lot of focus group tested rhetoric out there.
I can tell you, as a matter of fact, being there, there were that was run of by and for the Tea Party. I mean, they controlled that whole debate. I would bet.
By the Tea Party, you mean the Koch brothers?
Yeah, the Koch brothers. The Americans for Prosperity, I believe. They had the bus there. They had the famous bus there.
The moneyed interest. There's some people who say, well, they're a Tea Party, or there's just a couple of people. No, we're talking about the moneyed people.
Well, my point is this. They actually got him on Fox News, on the Sean Hannity show. And to show you, I felt sorry for the guy. I certainly disagreed with him. I thought he made an absolute fool of himself. But he was a poor soul. Sean Hannity actually gave him three chances to speak, and he, for whatever reason, he couldn't even get words out. The man was that pathetic. It was like they were using him, almost abusing him, and you can bet that the right wing were the ones who were controlling what he said, and exactly what you said. They had talking points, and this is the kind of guy who all he needed was a push. And the irony was, here's the irony, Rick. He blamed it on the government. He blamed it on the government because he said he wasn't getting adequate medicine to address his real severe problems. And he did have some severe problems, and I do believe the man when he said he had severe pain. But here's the problem. The insurer who was covering him, the medical insurer wouldn't give him the medicine. It wasn't the government.
Had nothing to do with the government.
Now, somebody used this guy and persuaded him that, well, it was the government's fault. Well, no, it wasn't the government's fault. It was his health care carrier. And at the end of the day, oh, shock of all shocks, probably came down to money.
Yep.
And that's how...
And the Tea Party people!
That's how these people were used. And I honestly, from a human standpoint, I felt sorry for him because he was just such a poor soul.
And you saw that, and I think we saw that across the country. These people who really didn't have a firm grasp of any ideology, let alone what theirs was, were coming out just angry and frustrated. And, you know, I guess I understand that. Speaking of confused, Salon.com had a piece that I found interesting. Alex Perrine has written this piece about Pamela Gilar. You may remember her. She's the remember when they were talking about putting the mosque at Ground Zero that wasn't really at Ground Zero? Well, she was the blogger who was 100% against it. And there was such outrage and such fervor and such anger, and there were people protesting in the streets. And, you know, this woman made a couple of bucks doing it. She's still against the mosque at Ground Zero. Instead, she wants to put a Walmart there. He writes, obsessive anti-Islam blogger Pamela Gilar is having another New York rally in support of bigotry and insanity. This time, though, there's a twist. She's still protesting the imaginary Ground Zero mosque, but she wants everyone to know that she's in favor of Walmart, the giant retail chain that has successfully held the lead in America's race to the bottom, would like to expand into New York City. The city council is against the idea. Gilar obviously supports Walmart because liberals dislike Walmart, and liberals love Muslims, and Muslims hate America. Therefore, Walmart is good, and Walmart loves America. So she puts out this crazy little flyer with the Walmart happy face wearing a veil with a whole bunch of really bizarre, twisted messages. The Islamic crescent is in the name, what the Walmart thing is with the hyphen. It's really just bizarre. But these are the folks who are pushing the debate. These are the folks who are out there pushing the envelope. And the sad thing is, I just spent about 45 seconds talking about her. And many news organizations are. Because insanity
sells.
Exactly. And, you know, you look at this, the fact that, well, Muslim bad, Walmart good. Walmart has done an awful lot to help hurt this country. But we want a Walmart on Ground Zero. In fact, I think that would be fitting. In fact, I may support this with her. I'm thinking it through. I'm trying to go through how I'm thinking this through, because I think maybe that would be indicative of how our nation has turned. Instead of, you know, the monuments, put up a Walmart.
Well, not in New York City. I didn't know that, by the way. I didn't know that New York City banned Walmart, but good for them. It's about time communities stand up.
Well, they didn't ban it. The city council just doesn't want it. They don't want to give them a permit to build, which good for them.
Well, I'm sure. I mean, I'm giving kudos to the labor movement here. I'm sure there was some pressure from labor to that extent.
That I do not know. But, yeah, again, crazy is crazy does. Let's take a quick break. Right back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
In response to Tea Party agitation, the new Republican leaders in the House have been strutting around as reformers, coming across as suit-and-tie versions of that guy on the TV show, Dirty Jobs. "We're going to clean up the place," they exclaim, starting with that big legislative stain called earmarks. No more secret diversions of taxpayers' money into lawmakers' pet pork barrel projects, decreed the new House Speaker, John Boehner. Posing as a reborn Mr. Clean, Boehner fairly sparkled at a press conference to announce that he was banning earmarks. So that's that. Mission accomplished, right? No. What the GOP has done is simply sweep earmarks under the rug. Take Senator Mark Stephen Kirk, for example. The Illinois Republican was a scathing critic of earmarks last year, even as he used his position on the Appropriations Committee to force the Education Department to funnel more than $1 million of stimulus money into an Illinois school district. Sounds like an earmark, doesn't it? But technically it wasn't. Rather than directing the money to Illinois by way of the appropriations bill, he did it by way of a letter to the department. This is known to insiders like Kirk as letter marking. There's also phone marking, where the dirty deed is done by a phone call from a legislator to an agency head. Another slick move called account marking happens when a member pads the budget of a particular agency, then demands that the extra funds be spent on the member's special project. All of these slick tricks add up to billions of tax dollars every year. This is Jim Hightower saying, Mr. Clean wants our applause for a change that is nothing but a deceit. In an act of raw hypocrisy, Boehner has changed the name of the earmark game, but the scam remains the same. Now, think about it. That really is a dirty job, isn't it?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Yeah! Sold! Sold for rock bottom prices. Welcome to the fire sale, otherwise known as the government of the state of Pennsylvania. Because that's what's going to happen. That's what we're looking down the barrel of. We're looking down the barrel of the fire sale and all the things that we've paid for over the last couple hundred years up on the auction block. All of the assets that you and I own, gone. And at a time, really honestly, truthfully, at a time when you're not going to be able to fetch the highest price. You look at this ridiculous notion that we're gonna sell off the wine and spirit shops. And we've talked about it a number of times. They're going to get $2 billion. Yeah. And I've got a bridge. And here in Pennsylvania, saying I have a bridge that's not crumbling would probably be as likely as me selling you the Brooklyn Bridge. So I got this news report. The News Post staff, the Frederick's News Post, did a compliance check. The police in Frederick, Maryland, on Wednesday, December 29th, conducted this compliance check. They went around to 19 businesses that sold alcohol, and guess what they found? they found 14 establishments sold alcohol to underage volunteers. Now, remember what the right wing saying about underage drinking? That, well, you know, we'll be able to control that. Other states do. You don't see stories like this in Pennsylvania because alcohol does not get into the hands of underage kids. And, you know, I loved the Tinky Tanks expert saying, well, you know, the free market has spoken. And, you know, what's going on is you have all these establishments who've set up on the Pennsylvania border because Pennsylvania's citizens, they want to be able to go and they want to get cheap prices and the choice, and they want to have all of this stuff. When we know that prices are not cheaper and there's not a better choice, the reason those stores are there are, like my ex-wife used to say, we used to go across the border into New Jersey to buy alcohol. And you talk to college students, they go across the border into Maryland to buy alcohol. And this story in Frederick, Maryland, kind of lays that out. 14 out of 19. If you could hit 14 out of 19 in Major League Baseball, you would be a billionaire. They would put you in the Hall of Fame immediately. You know, if Shaquille O'Neal could have made 14 out of 19 free throws, the world would stop moving. Stop and think about the percentage here. 14 out of 19. You're talking almost 70. You're talking over 70%. 70% of the establishments in that area sold alcohol to underage volunteers. Now, is that what we want here? Do we want to go down this path towards the auctioneer? I don't think so. You know, here's what I find interesting. You know, I guess selling alcohol to minors in the state of Maryland has a fine of up to 2 years imprisonment and a fine of $1,000. Rarely does anyone go to jail. When I was in Cleveland, you never saw those guys going to jail. Okay, they got taken away. They closed down for a night. They paid a couple of dollar fine, you know, maybe once a year. But all of the money that they generated week in, week out, because we at the local high school were frequenting their establishments, made up for it. And, you know, this is what we're heading towards. It's this kind of thing that I'm afraid of. And you can call me a hypocrite because I did it when I was a young man, that I don't want my kids doing it. I think it's a basic parental thing. But beyond this, beyond the easy access, and I'm telling you, if we cede control to private interests who are seeking only profit, we will see these stories about Pennsylvania. I'm telling you right now. But even if you do away with the societal stuff, even if you do away with, you know, hey, we'll put a bottle of booze in every kid's pocket, booze will be everywhere. There'll be liquor stores on every corner of every street, competing with each other to sell to, you know, six-year-olds in strollers. Even if you cede all of that, economically, it makes no sense because I'm telling you, you're not getting $2 billion. And I would like to get Mike Terzai to come on the program, and we've got to work on that. Where did this number come from? Where did you pull it out of? What research has been done? And I'm under the impression that there's none. I have yet to see anything factually based. I have seen a report that was produced back in the 90s. That when revised and done properly said we'll get about $300 million. I've seen that, which I'm telling you, I don't even think we would get that now in this economic environment because, you know, who's going to lend mom and pop $2.5 million to buy a liquor store in the middle of nowhere? Nobody. So all this ends up being is another product on the shelf. Another product at the convenience store, another product at the grocery store. And then you and I, the taxpayers. And this is the part that gets me. And, you know, and I appeal to my big government people because this is a big government thing. We're going to have to hire regulators. From now till eternity, you're going to have people who check the books, make sure that every penny of taxes are being paid. You're going to have people inspecting the stores to make sure that, oh, I don't know, kids aren't getting the stuff. You're going to have to inspect it so that you're selling the right stuff. They're not doing some hanky stuff, putting half water in. Who knows? But we're going to have to hire those folks. And that's a cost down the road. I say leave it right where it is. It's fine the way it is. Whenever I need a bottle of something, I know where to go. I'm going to pay a reasonable price for it. It's going to be done in a way that my taxes go right to where it's supposed to, and I don't have to worry about somebody skimming off the top. I know that it's done right.
One number that really jumps out at me, there were some studies done right. In fact, there's a total of 17 studies done when you compare states that once had a controlled system and went to privatization. On average, the increase in alcoholic beverage sales went up 42%. Now, if you look at the numbers, to get the $2 billion, even at $1 million a sale, they are going to have to increase the number of state stores by 250%. Is that what we want, 2,000 state stores in the state of Pennsylvania? Now, are you telling me that they tout this mom-and-pop stuff? Let's just take them up on that. Let's say, for argument's sake, half of them are mom-and-pop stores, and we know that isn't going to happen, but certainly a percentage of them will. Do you think for 1 minute that they're not going to hire part-timers at minimum wage? Many of them, probably teenagers themselves, a lot of them below the drinking age, who are not going to sell. It's going to be just like beer at a bar. When you have beer at a bar, you know how it works, Rick. If you look 21 and they know you, and even if they know you're under 21, they'll probably sell it to you. But if you look 21, if you look 25, like you probably did, they'll give it to you. My point is, not only are these numbers deceiving, I don't think they're going to get anywhere near $2 billion. But beyond that, the problems that we're going to have to deal with, including more deaths on the highways caused by underage drinking.
By idiots like me, who the first time he drank an entire fifth of Canadian Windsor. That's the problem. Anyway, let's go to the phones. We got Mike on line one. How are we doing tonight, Mike?
Hey, Rick, this is a synergistic model here. There's not going to be any regulators. There's not going to be anybody overlooking any of this stuff because they're cutting government. When they sell those liquor stores, remember, the Liquor Control Board, operative word control, is funded out of those funds.
Right.
There's not going to be any funds for regulators. And there aren't going to be any regulators because most of them have been laid off.
But I got to tell you, I think that as soon as the first teenager gets behind the wheel and kills somebody, I do believe you're going to have to see, you will see them putting people out there, if nothing more than as a visual deterrent, if not an actual deterrent.
What they do is they respond locally to that, and they make a few stops and have a little visibility. But effectively, there will be no regulation. And again, once they start destroying the living wage for state workers, the people that you're going to get to do this are going to be people who are desperate, and desperate people sometimes can be influenced, shall we say.
Yep.
This is a race to the bottom. This is a spiral to the bottom.
Of course it is. It's what they want. They want to auction off all of the state assets. They want nothing for we the people. They want to be able to profit from everything that we have invested in.
And it's going to be, and I hate to say it, but we're headed for the third world, and it's going to happen a lot faster than anybody thinks. And the current, this administration, if they do what they're saying they're going to do, and they have no reason not to because they have all the cards,
yep,
and they can do it quickly.
Yeah, there's no stopping it.
Right. They can ask and do by statute all sorts of things. They can get rid of the income. They could repeal Act 195. If they do that, stroke of the pen, there's no right then in Pennsylvania for public worker collective bargaining. It's gone.
Do you think he would really do something that divisive that would cause a real visceral reaction like that? Do you think he would do something like that?
But there's nobody who understands this stuff. our biggest problem is that the majority of the people that, that currently we represent don't have any clue about the history of collective bargaining and how it came about and the dues that were paid, the price that was paid in order to get to where we are. They don't know. I mean, all they've known is I go to work for the state, I get a certain salary, and every 4 years it's a contract and I get more money. And that's open because people aren't active and they haven't paid attention. And management was the first to find out. They turned around and said, but wait a minute, what happened to my raise? And they were told, excuse us, you don't have a contract. You don't get a raise unless it's by our good graces, and we don't have any. So, yeah, do I think you do that? Yeah, I think you'll do that.
No, I sure hope not. Man, I sure hope not.
I mean, if they believe their press, if they live up to their mantra, there's no reason why on Tuesday Act 195 couldn't be gone.
I don't have a response for you, Mike. That's maybe when the proverbial pile hits the fan then. Maybe that gets somebody's attention. Maybe then we begin again. Maybe that's the moment that, you know, I've been talking about. That moment of pain where people go, holy Toledo, Batman.
I mean, theoretically, this is somewhat gloom and doom, but it's completely possible, and I'm seeing it from other governors around the state. They could come in, do away with Act 195, pick up the phone and call the union and say, you're done. Throw the contract out. Well, the contract's up in June anyway, but they could just say, well, we're done. And then turn around to the employee and say, well, okay, we're cutting your 20%. You're going to pay, $500 a month for your benefits. And I ask people, what are you going to do about it?
And that's the
question. Well, there's nothing you can do. You have two choices.
You walk out the door.
You can show up at work or not.
That's it.
Those are your choices.
That's it. And that's the only choice that workers ever have. Is
right.
To work or not to work.
And everything that they've taken for granted, they're fixing to find out what their parents fought for. They're going to find out because it's going to be all taken away and it's going to happen so fast that they're going to be amazed where it has that potential.
Yeah, it has the potential. You're absolutely right, Mike. I appreciate the call, buddy. I'm hoping that's not the case, but we'll find out next Tuesday, won't we?
I'm seeing very disturbing things. I got to tell you, very, very, very disturbing things.
Well,
see you, Rick.
Man, thanks so much, Mike. You talk about this stuff, and you start to prepare to fight back, and you know, you look at what we've done, what we've decided as voters in this state. The trouble that we're going to be seeing. And it's going to hit everybody. It's not something, oh, it's just those state workers. Nothing ever happens in a bubble. Everything trickles down. And we're all going to feel the pain. Let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
Tonight, that you could always speak your mind. You worked so hard to say what's right. I watched you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call Call them at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. Chances are you may never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, inspecting an elevator, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Time to get involved is right now. Time to stand up and have your voice heard right now. Before and you hear those things, the negative stuff, the really toxic stuff that could be happening. And you hope that it doesn't get to that. You hope that we haven't become so divided that the Republicans want to destroy working conditions in this state. But you know what? Their history has shown that to be the case. You look back today in 1919, Seattle Mayor Ole Hansen ordered police to raid an open-air mass meeting of shipyard workers in an attempt to prevent a general strike. Workers were brutally beaten. The strike began the following month with 60,000 workers walking out in solidarity with some 25,000 metal tradesmen. You know, I often wonder, do we have that kind of societal unity? Do we have the ability to bring people together around a common cause? You know, you listen to the rhetoric that's being spewed. It's all about the individual. It's all about me. And it's been that way for years. I mean, the Reagan Revolution brought us the me generation, brought us the hooray for me and the heck with everybody else. And I go back to yesterday, back during the Roosevelt administration, a little history from there, and 1944 and his State of the Union address, he talked about a Bill of Rights, a second Bill of Rights for working people, for all people. The right to a useful and remunerative job. The right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation. The right of every businessman, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home or abroad. The right to every family to have a decent home. The right of adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health. The right to adequate protection from economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, unemployment. The right to a good education. We're not talking about that stuff anymore. We're talking about how can we put more money in the hands of people who already have a lot of money. We're talking about how can I get mine. And I go back to the poem that I read earlier about the two bums. You know, you've got these very wealthy folks, the luxury class. They don't care about the people below them. They never really did. It was a nice PR stunt, nice PR schemes. And that's what they're good at. They're good at saying, oh, look how much we care. Oh, look at how wonderfully we did. I point to the Hurricane Katrina thing where Walmart took a couple of trucks down into Louisiana and they spent $18 million promoting the fact that they took a couple of trucks of water and food into Louisiana. Why? They understand messaging. And we don't. And this is the kind of stuff we've got to be talking about. How do we make sure that every person has the ability to work? earn enough money to feed their families, to feed and clothe and to keep their families together. How do we do that? How do we make sure that everybody has the opportunity for the American dream of a home and the things that come along with that? Certainly not by having a race to the bottom, hooray for me and screw everybody else mentality.
And perhaps you are right, and we keep talking about this issue, but we seem to be getting closer and closer and closer to finding out. Perhaps there aren't enough people who suffered. You talked about the 60,000 tradesmen that went out on strike, but I'm sure every one of those tradesmen knew what it was like to be without a union, knew what it was like to basically live from day to day. Many people today assume, well, you know, the middle class will always be there. I will always have enough to take care of my family. That's not true anymore. Too many people don't know what it is to go without. During the 80s, labor movement and the Democratic Party had a problem. Why? Because the labor movement was that successful that the average worker, some of them, they moved out of the big cities. They moved out of their working class neighborhoods. And they moved out to the suburbs, and they bought, you know, they bought 3, 4, 5 acres of land, and they kind of got, that's right, that's exactly right. They had theirs, and kind of their attitude was, you know, I made it on my own, why should I have to pay for somebody else? And they became the Reagan Democrats.
And that's the beginning of it. And, you know, you go back to George Meany, who said, how do you get a guy, back in the 60s, how do you get a guy to go on strike when he's making 10 grand a year? Which back in the 60s was an awful lot of money. How do you get somebody to do that when they're doing all right? How do you get them to fight for social justice for other people when their lives are pretty good? I remember my first union job. I remember my first real full-time union job. I worked, the old-timers back then would take the young guys under their arms and say, you know, come on, I'll show you the way, kid. And he told me the advice I took from him right from the beginning was you've got to be willing to walk out that door and stand up for your rights at the drop of a hat. He said the first thing that you should do is build 6 months of wages in the bank. You should have a cushion in case you have to go out and fight for what you have. Because the only way you keep the decent wages, the decent benefits, the things that you have, is by looking the boss in the eye and say, you know what? I'm willing to walk out that door with the rest of my brothers and sisters and stand out there and not come to work. Because that's the only thing that we have. That's the only thing working people actually have, is their ability to withhold their labor. That's it. And the solidarity of everybody else around them not to screw you when you do. You know, when I look, you know, we talked about the Jack London quote about a scab, and, you know, that's funny, ha-ha, but at the end of it, when somebody's willing to horn in on your job when you're having a contract thing, when you have people willing to cross a picket line, it's like, Jake, if you and your wife were having some marital problems, and I said, you know what? Hey, Jake's having a little problem over there. Maybe I'll go comfort the missus.
You scoundrel, you.
It's the exact same thing in my mind.
Well, you know, the investor class isn't stupid. That when they came up with things like credit cards and easy mortgage terms, you know, they got working.
Right in.
They got working people right where they wanted them.
You got a taste of the good life.
I've been on quite a few. Well, I've been on my share of strikes. Let's put it that way. I can still remember people the first week. Oh, when were you going back? I'm in debt up to my ears. That's exactly where they want you.
Well, it goes back to what I was saying about this old timer saying, "Look, you got to have, a cushion, because when it happens, and it's going to happen." Because even in the early, late 80s, early 90s, when I started, you understood that, you know, being a Teamster in the freight industry was a dying breed, because the trucking companies were going out of business left and right. Not because the unions had jacked the wages through the roof, but because deregulation had pretty much stuck it to all of the existing companies. Because these companies had all of their assets tied up into their rights. So as soon as you made those rights worthless, they were really stuck holding a big bag of nothing. And they had to pay for that big bag of nothing. So you saw Teamster groups going out of business left and right. These companies that were represented by the Teamsters, at one point in the LTL industry, in the less than truckload industry, you had 85% of the trucks on the road were represented by the Teamsters. So you had a good, solid living wage for 85% of that industry. So you know the other 15%, they paid the equal wages. So it brought everybody up. We're not talking about that in this environment right now. We're talking about how do they tear down public sector workers? How do we tear down people who have health care? How do we tear down people who have pensions? Instead of saying, how do we raise all of us up to that level? How do I get it? How do I make things better for my family? I make things better for your family. So we don't have people like this kid in Arizona who has, from all indications, this kid was never going to amount to anything. He had nothing in his mind to look forward to. Nothing. And you get this kind of irrational behavior from people who have nothing tomorrow. If you've got nothing to wake up for tomorrow.
He wanted his 15 minutes of fame.
Oh, and he got it. You look at that goofy smile picture he has in the paper. He's got to be happy ear to ear because you know every newspaper is going to run it. And what's that say about us?
You know he's not playing with a full deck when you bring him to court and he faces 6 counts of murder. And he acts like it's a day at the beach. He's a brick load of, he's a brick or two short of a full load, as we used to say. Or the elevator ain't going to the top, use whatever expression you want. I mean, unfortunately for a lot of people that are dead, the man just doesn't have full control of his faculties. And herein is where the Glenn Becks and all the people who like to use this rhetorical this is the language that will fire people up. There are a lot of people out there, especially with the economic conditions, who don't take all that much. They don't take all that much to push you over the edge.
See, I'm not buying this whole he was not in, and this is where we'll probably disagree. I'm not buying this whole he wasn't in control of his faculties. I think he knew exactly what he was doing. I think he planned it to the letter because he wanted that 15 minutes of fame. I'm not going there.
You can be insane and still have some logic, right?
Yeah, well.
I'm not just saying.
Just because someone does something that appears to the rational to be insane, I'm just not going there.
Well, there's a lot of evidence that he had some severe problems.
He had some problems, and we all do. I saw a report that, three-quarters of the people in this country could clinically be classified as depressed. So if three-quarters of us are walking around depressed, then three quarters of us are capable of doing these kind of things.
Some people get depressed when they don't have their pizza pie for the day. How far do you want to take that? Well, I mean, I'm trying to joke here. This isn't a joking matter, but that whole situation. At the end of the day, we can all agree on this. Some of the language that's used by and it is true. I don't care what the right wing says. There's more of it on the right. Because there's a lot of people making a living, making millions every year.
Outraging the outrage.
I mean, who do you want to name? You name them. Glenn Beck, Michael Savage. I mean, that guy, wow. You talk
Michael
about,
Reagan, the guy with the point in the gun for his promo picture is another one.
I mean, you just go down the road.
Michelle Malkin.
There's another one.
Poltergeist. They're all in a crowded pack. And they've got to distinguish themselves they've got to distinguish themselves by being as outrageous as possible. So when Tucker Carlson said, "Oh, we should execute Michael Vick," that got news.
I can't believe that little twerp would say that, Mr. Bowtie.
Look,
he couldn't beat up a fly.
Well, he did beat up that gay guy in the bathroom.
You mean his buddy did?
Oh, that's right. Him and his buddy went back. That's right.
That little twerp.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to wrap things up. If you missed any portion of the show, you can go to thericksmithshow.com, and it will be there for you. Also, you can podcast, you can watch the video, all kind of stuff at thericksmithshow.com. We're right back after this.
Let us get sick. Don't let us get old. Don't let us get stupid, all right. Just make us be brave, make us play nice, let us be together tonight.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart.
The voice of the working class, Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
If you or a loved one has suffered a workplace injury, don't jeopardize your benefits by not fully knowing your rights. Don't be misled by those whose job it is to minimize your injury, your disability, your lifetime medical coverage, and your financial recovery. Order your free book by Calhoun Associates by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 695-4722. Don't be taken advantage of. Get your copy of The Seven Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 717-695-4722.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made, and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Well, today, back in 1962, President John F. Kennedy signed the Executive Order 10988 guaranteeing federal workers the right to join unions and collectively bargain. And ever since that day, you have had the business community, you have had the Republican Party going nuts. How can we take this away? How can we destroy this? Back in 68... you had Martin Luther King marching with the sanitation workers in Memphis for just that. Something to help them lead a better life. And now you've got this whole push. How do we take what those folks have fought, bled, and died for away? You know, we shouldn't be talking about how do we take things away from public sector workers, how to take things away from private sector workers. We should be talking about how do we have a fair and equitable economy? We're talking about taking pensions away from workers when the richest top 1% in this country are walking away with the entire pie. You and I get a crumb of that pie. They're walking away with the whole thing. You look at the billionaires who raked in all untold wealth, the hedge fund managers, the private equity managers, the folks who their income is an income. It's capital gains. Therefore, they pay a 15% flat tax, which then they can start deducting with all of their loopholes. And you go back and you look at the people who are working for the state, firefighters, sanitation workers, policemen, teachers, social workers, these people that the right to call faceless bureaucrats, hooligans, making money off of you. You know, I have a friend who's a cop, and he said the one thing that galls him the most is when he pulls somebody over, and he gives him a ticket because they were, and my buddy doesn't give out many tickets. He's one of these guys you have to really be obnoxious to get his attention. So he'll pull somebody over, and he says, you know, it invariably it never fails. You get this, I pay your salary. And it's this mentality that the right has really pushed that those public sector workers, those policemen, those firemen, they're servants of mine. They're here to serve me, and they're accountable to me. So once you make them second-class citizens, it's easy then to look at them and say, oh, yeah, we can take their pensions away. Oh, yeah, they can work for peanuts. Oh, yeah, we can destroy their working conditions. It's about demonizing. It's about tearing them down. And in making really wild and bizarre accusations about, oh, well, they make hundreds of thousands of dollars in pension. When the reality is, you know, after a typical career of making in the $40,000 range, the average person retires with about 19 grand. That, my friends, is not living high off the hog. And in most cases, these folks don't qualify. They don't get Social Security because the state and the federal government doesn't pay into it. Now, I had a conversation with this guy who runs Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania, who told me I was dead flat wrong, that federal employees, they pay into Social Security. No, they don't. And I double-checked into it. There are some state employees who get it, but for the most part, sorry, not happening. So that retirement that you're talking about is in lieu of the $14,000 or $15,000 that the average person gets in Social Security. And what's even worse about this is you've got these Republicans out there who are just distorting this stuff. The quote that you showed me with Mitt Romney. Oh, they make $30,000 more than the average, you know, worker. Really?
Boy, he pulled that out of you-know-what that day.
But there's nobody to fact check him. There's no one to say, like I did to this guy over here at the Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania, who said, you know, Bethlehem Steel, they used to get 15 weeks vacation every single year.
Do you want to know the truth on that?
And I said, no, they didn't.
No. It was 13 every 5 years, and only if the company could let you go. And guess what? Where I worked, a few miles down the road, if you averaged in that five-year period, we had a better vacation plan
than
most
people do. 13 weeks in 5 years?
No, once every 5 years, they were eligible for 13 weeks. But they were eligible only if the company could let them go. But if you average in their vacation plan, and where I worked, ours was better. But the average person doesn't know that.
But it sounds a good soundbite. And I told him, I said, you know what? When I did some research on a paper I had done years ago, there was a company in the 50s that offered their employees every 10 years, if they didn't miss a day of work and they didn't take any vacation, in those 10 years, they would get an entire year off paid vacation. I said, you should look up that. That's a good talking point. They would get a whole year vacation.
Is that true?
Yeah. It was one company that did it. But you couldn't miss any days. You couldn't take any vacations. I mean, it was narrowly confined that, you know, maybe a handful of people got it. But it's...
Well, he basically owns you then if you're not taking vacations.
Exactly.
Who would want to do that?
And I would assume it was kind of those places that you really probably couldn't.
And most of the people never made it.
No. But, you know, they're talking about taking us back, though, folks. Talking about denying the right to bargain.
Well, you know, an interesting anecdote. I don't know if we have time. I'm quickly going to tell it. We had this perfect attendance policy, and they would give you X number of dollars if you had perfect attendance. This one guy had like 15 years, and he was sick as a dog, and he kept coming to work. Well, he got pneumonia,
yeah,
was off for a couple weeks.
Yeah, he was the richest man in the grid.
Just about.
Anyway, I want to thank everybody for being here tonight, our callers, our guests. Thanks for being here, Erwin Aronson. Scott from the Owner Operators Association, Lee Fong from the Center for American Progress, Brett, our chief engineer over there, the guy who slides the knobs and answers the phone, does a great job of doing that. Also, thank you for being here. Our podcast listeners, thanks so much. Also, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I do enjoy the interaction and look forward to hearing from you. Had a couple I wanted to get to tonight. We'll get to them tomorrow. So thanks for being here. And we will see you back here tomorrow night, as every weeknight, 9 to midnight. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickssmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the sway.
Imperial, mysterious, and amorous reign. Democracy is coming.